Good evening and welcome to the Arroyo Grande City Council meeting for Tuesday, February 24th, 2015. May I have a roll call, please?
I'll be doing the roll call this evening. The clerk's a bit late. She had to retrieve something from City Hall. Councilmember Harmon?
Here.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Here.
Mayor Pro Tem Barnidge?
Here.
And Mayor Hill?
Here. Thank you very much. Please join us in a moment of reflection. Thank you. Tonight for the flag salute, we have Dr. Joseph Skoda from Toastmasters International. If you'd like to come up and lead us in the flag salute, please.
Please stand, face the flag. Repeat after me. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, liberty and justice for all.
Thank you. And if you'd like to tell us a little bit about Toastmasters.
Sure. Every Tuesday morning, 7 o'clock, right here, we practice speaking. We practice our communication skills. I'm the president of South County Presenters, and we practice communicating with one another. A lot of us think we know what we're talking about, but sometimes the other side don't understand what we're saying. So we'd love to have any of you join us anytime. I'm going to leave a flyer with the city clerk, but I'd love to have you and see what we're all about. But Toastmasters is a great organization.
Thank you very much. Okay, this evening we have no closed session announcements. And we'd like to move that all ordinances presented for introduction or adoption be read in title only and all further readings be waived.
So moved.
Second.
It's been moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Carries unanimously. This evening we have two special presentations. Is Mary here? Okay, this is a presentation honoring, recognized in February 24th, 2015 as World Spay Day. It's whereas pets provide companionship to 68% of households in the United States, whereas nearly 3 million healthy and adoptable cats and dogs are put down in animal shelters each year due to lack of critical resources and public awareness, whereas spaying and neutering has been shown to dramatically reduce the overpopulation of pets, whereas programs exist to assist with the cost of spaying or neutering pets, and whereas veterinarians, national and local animal protection organizations, and private citizens work together to ensure the spaying or neutering of more than 68,000 pets throughout the world in 2014, whereas veterinarians, national and local animal protection organizations, private citizens have joined together again to advocate the spaying and neutering of pets on World Spay Day 2015, therefore, be it resolved that I, Jim Hill, Mayor of the City of Arroyo Grande, and on behalf of the City Council, do hereby proclaim February 24th, 2015 as World Spay Day and encourage the citizens of Arroyo Grande to have their own pets spayed or neutered by sponsoring or spaying the spaying or neutering of another person's pet. So, we present the proclamation. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me here tonight. My name is Mary Buna Kemper, and I'm from the Feline Network. But I'm really here as a representative for all the animal rescue groups in the South County. Spay and neuter for dogs, cats, and rabbits is really important, and it has been proved that fewer animals are euthanized, pets are healthier, fewer vet bills with toms roaming and getting into fights. Let me just tell you a little bit about the Feline Network. That's the group that I'm from. We basically do three different programs. We've been in existence about 12 or 13 years. So I think in the South County, we really have seen a much stronger reduction in the number of animals that have been euthanized at the shelter. We have a spay-neuter certificate or voucher program that provides to the public to have their own pet spayed or neutered. Any vet in the county will take those certificates, and for a female, it is $60 against the vet bill, and for a male, $40. That is only for the South County. That's the area that we handle. We also, sometimes there's feral cat colonies that are created when a mama cat will have the baby cats, and then all of a sudden you have more cats than you need. And if they don't have human interaction, they become feral. We do have a trap-neuter return program, and so there is a dire need for trappers in the South County. If we get the animals quick enough, let's say there's a feral mama and she has the babies, if we get them early enough, they can be socialized, and then they can become your family pet. So we also have a rescue part. So education is really key, but spay-neuter really is a very important thing. Thank you.
This evening we also have a commendation for Christopher Martinez, and I'd like to introduce Chief Lieberman to say a few words first.
Thank you, Mayor, and good evening, Council. I'm Steve Lieberman. I'm your fire chief, and I'm here tonight to share what we all love about community. Christopher Martinez is a member of our Reserve Firefighter Program. Our Reserve Program are not permanent employees. We typically hire folks that come out of the fire academies that are motivated and ready to expand their portfolios and their resumes and with the full knowledge that we'll probably only have them for a short period before they enter in with another career agency. They're committed to our communities and they're fine people, and tonight is a great example. I always talk about a great organization is defined by character, and Christopher Martinez is certainly one of those. Chris lives in Santa Barbara but serves our communities, and he came across two local boys who were battling severe illness and took it upon himself to start a fundraising site to raise $10,000 and run in the Huntington Beach Marathon, wearing structural firefighting equipment, including a breathing apparatus pack, a Nomex hood around his neck. The only thing he wasn't wearing were gloves and boots. He completed the marathon. Here's some photos of him. That's 58 pounds of gear before you start sweating. A Los Angeles television station picked up the story of Chris before the marathon, and I believe with the added exposure as seen on KTLA's Facebook page. A lot of women stopped him along the course for selfies, by the way. Chris was successful in actually raising $20,000 for these children and their families. Sadly, we're about to lose Chris to a career with a larger fire agency, but I do want to take this moment, Mayor, to recognize him and what he's done for us. Thank you, sir.
And again tonight, this is a mayor's commendation presented to Christopher Martinez of the Five Cities Fire Authority in recognition of your participation in and successful completion of the Huntington Beach Surf City Marathon on February 1, 2015, while wearing 50 pounds of structural firefighting gear, the turnout and everything as you saw, as a fundraising effort for two local boys who continue to fight their battle against cancer. Your compassion, resilience, and focus to push yourself for these two young boys truly illustrate your commitment to public service, dated this day, 24th day of February 2015. So on behalf of the City Council and myself, Congratulations, and thank you very much.
We want to get you on the camera. I mean,
no disrespect, my back's towards you.
Try to talk to all of you guys. Chief knows, and the guys in the back, my battalion chiefs and captains know this is kind of an awkward thing for me. I don't like individual acknowledgement. I see myself as part of a team. And in our books, in our task books, we have like certain things we have to accomplish as a firefighter with Five Cities Fire Authority. And one of them is called seat assignments. And I asked my captain at the time, who's Captain Ferguson, who's in the back, and my engineer, McMahon, what seat assignments was. And there they go. That's where I'd rather be. I asked him what seat assignments was, and after about 2 hours of talking about seat assignments, about what everyone's responsibility is on different hazards of the local community, fires or car accidents or whatnot, I didn't really learn something as a firefighter, but I learned something as a person, of being part of Five Cities Fire Authority, and that's that everybody does a particular job as a team to accomplish a goal, and it really sat in with me. And even though I didn't know the CODAs, I didn't know Mateo or Phineas, Five Cities Fire Authority taught me that, and they do it every day in helping strangers, and that's what you do, and you do the right thing in your community, regardless of how extreme it may sound, you do it. And you fight through it, and you're part of a team. And so I didn't do it alone. I did it, everybody in my department, and I appreciate their support, their unwavering support through it. I know half of them thought I was crazy, but it was more of a big brother crazy, if that makes sense. And I hold the department and everybody in the department a special place in my heart. And even though my name's on this, I really want to acknowledge that there's a bigger name, and that's the Five Cities Fire Authority. And it's my honor. As much as I'm honored today to be acknowledged for it, I'm also honored to be a part of them. And so thank you, and everybody have a wonderful evening.
That brings us to community comments and suggestions. Any member of the public can address the City Council on anything that's not on the agenda this evening. For items that are on the agenda this evening, there'll be an opportunity to comment on each of those as we get to them on the agenda. We would respectfully request that, due to the large turnout this evening, that you limit your comments, please, to 3 minutes. And the city clerk has a clock to help with that. There won't be any buzzer or anything, but we do appreciate you self-regulating there to 3 minutes, if at all possible. That'll help allow everybody to speak and get us through the meeting in good order. So with that, is there anyone who would like to address the council this evening?
Hello, my name is Linda Osti. I live on Cherry Street in the village of Arroyo Grande. And I want to share with you an invocation delivered at a Philadelphia City Council meeting on October 20th, 2011. Teddy Roosevelt was a man who had a reputation for being frank and direct. In 1900, a year before he entered the White House, he wrote these words: "No community is healthy where it is ever necessary to distinguish one politician from his fellow because he is honest. Moreover, it is not enough that public officials should be honest. No amount of honesty will avail if he is not also brave and wise. The weakling and the coward cannot be saved by honesty alone. Leadership requires two virtues that seem very simple until they become very inconvenient: honesty and courage. All of you have earned the right to be here today by winning the trust of the people of Philadelphia, and in our case of Arroyo Grande. But along with that honor comes a duty of humility, integrity, and public service. So let's settle our hearts for a moment in prayer. God of justice and mercy, thank you for the gift of life and the opportunity to serve the people of our city. Help us to act with character and conviction. Help us to listen with understanding and goodwill. Help us to speak with charity and restraint. Give us spirit of service. Remind us that we are stewards of your authority. Guide us to be leaders of the people as needed. Help us to see the humanity and the dignity of those who disagree with us, and to treat all persons, no matter how weak or poor, with reverence of your creation deserves. And finally, Father, renew us with the strength of your presence and the joy of helping to build a community worthy of the human person. We ask for this as your sons and daughters, confident in your goodness and love, in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.
Thank you. Would anyone else like to address the council this evening?
Good evening. I'm Debbie Wood. I live in Grover Beach. I'm here this evening in regards to the nomination for the Central Coast for a marine sanctuary. The nomination has been put in, and I have concerns about it. One, the major one being loss of local control. With this nomination, everything from the high water mark on the beaches, which is an average of the high tides over a recorded period, out through our ocean, will no longer be under local or state control. It will become part of the federal government lawmaking process. This will combine the Channel Islands to the Monterey Bay, which then takes up 400 contiguous miles of the California coastline. There's four criteria for the nomination. Everything that is addressed in the criteria is already covered by local, state, and even federal guidelines, laws, and statutes. There is a report on potential economic impacts, which states there will be 594 jobs and $23 million. It's a 17-page report. Within that report are 22 references, such as impossible to determine, complicated to draw a link, no current research makes this connection. Monterey Bay has been a marine sanctuary for 22 years, yet there are no statistics or research showing that it has gained them any economic benefits. My guess is if they were there, somebody would have proven it. Anyway, that's all I have to say. I just wanted everybody to be aware that this is coming, and it's not just the ocean. It affects everybody. Thank you.
Thank you. Would anyone else like to address the council this evening?
Patty Welsh, Arroyo Grande. An observation I made today as I was driving home is I see the guys out there with the big mowers mowing all our parks, and I see that we've got water conservation on the agenda again tonight. And one of the things I'd like to mention is that if there's any way to pick up the mower height so that the grass is 3 inches, it holds more water in, so you don't have to water the park as often, therefore saving money. So I think it might be something to look into. Thank you.
Thank you. Anyone else like to address the council this evening? Okay. Hearing none. Madam Clerk?
Yes. Item 8 is the consent agenda. This is a group of routine items that are considered by the council as a group. The recommendations for each item are noted on the agenda. Any member of the public who wishes to comment on any consent agenda item may do so at this time. Any council member may request that any item be pulled from the consent agenda to permit discussion or change the recommended course of action. The council may approve the remainder of the consent agenda on one motion.
Do any council members have a concern about the consent agenda?
No.
I just have one comment.
Yes, please.
I didn't want to pull anything, but on item 8C, we're asking for approval of a one-year extension to Water Boys, who does the city's retrofitting. And I actually had two citizens that told me probably within the last month and then about 8 months ago how they appreciated when water boys came over. I think there was a toilet that was changed out in one citizen, and I think that toilet in another one, and they had really nice things to say about the contractor water boys, very polite, very prompt, and so I just wanted to pass those good words along. Thank you. That's it.
Thank you. Would any member of the public like to comment on the consent agenda? Hearing none. Do we have a motion?
I'll move approval of items 8A through 8D.
Second.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded that we approve the items 8A through 8D, which is the consent agenda this evening. May I have a roll call, please?
Yes, I first will read the ordinance title on item 8A, 8D. 8D includes adoption of an ordinance entitled An Ordinance of the City Council of the City of Aurora Grande repealing Section 13.05.040, amending Section 13.05.030, and adding Chapter 13.07 to the Aurora Grande Municipal Code relating to water conservation and emergency water shortage restrictions and regulations. And with that, I'm sorry, I missed it.
Okay, any other council comments?
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Barnidge?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Councilmember Harmon?
Yes.
And Mayor Hill?
Yes. Okay, we have no public hearing items this evening and no old business. Brings us to item 11, new business.
Item 11A is consideration of a pre-application number 15-001, specific plan designation, general plan amendment, development code amendment, tentative tract map, and lot line adjustment. Location is Traffic Way and East Cherry Avenue, and the applicants are Dorfman Homes Incorporated, Mangano Homes Incorporated, and Aurora Grande Valley Japanese Welfare Association.
Okay, and Director McClish, do you have the staff report?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Mayor. Members of the council, Associate Planner Heffernan will give the staff report this evening.
Okay, thank you. Council reviewed and commented on a pre-application last July to consider a conceptual specific plan for a 15-acre site under three separate ownerships. The site is located on the south side of East Cherry Avenue between Traffic Way and Pacific Coast Railway Place, and is surrounded by residential development to the north and east, St. Barnabas Church to the south, and then a mobile home park to the southwest. Focus for this initial pre-application was on a residential development plan for subarea 2, which is shown on this particular slide. So it takes up the bulk of the whole area, subarea 2. Council then reviewed and commented on a second pre-application last November that then focused on subarea 3. So this property is owned by the Aurora Grande Valley Japanese Welfare Association. Their conceptual plan included four main garden zones with associated structures that included legacy archive building, community center, guest house, and a commercial kitchen. And then subarea 1, right off of Traffic Way there, is currently zoned Traffic Way mixed use, and right now there have not been any conceptual development plans for this particular piece of property. Because subareas 2 and 3 are currently zoned agriculture, mitigation is required for the loss of farmland. The city allows mitigation at a ratio of at least 1-to-1, and up to 2-to-1 of other agricultural land permanently protected compared to what land is lost from the agricultural zoning. This could be dedicated of a perpetual agricultural conservation easement or other method to ensure that the area chosen as mitigation shall not be subject to loss of its farm land soils. The city can also require in-lieu fees instead of, you know, conservation easement or something similar to that. Per the city's general plan, any land use conversion from agriculture to a non-agricultural land use designation requires an environmental impact report. All environmental issues related to the project, including ag conversion, traffic impacts, and water resources, will be addressed through that EIR process. At this time, even though there have been conceptual designs considered, there is not a specific project being proposed right now. So the applicant is simply seeking direction currently of whether council is comfortable proceeding with a general plan amendment to change the zoning from agriculture to other land use designations through the specific plan process. So this concludes staff's brief presentation, and I believe that the applicant's representative also has some words to say to present to you. Thank you.
The applicant like to come up now?
Thank you, Mr. Mayor, council members. My name is Carol Florence. I'm a principal planner with Oasis Associates located in San Luis Obispo. I'm very pleased to be here this evening on behalf of Ed Dorfman of Dorfman Homes, Andy Mangano of Mangano Homes, and the Arroyo Grande Valley Japanese Welfare Association. Collectively, the applicants respectfully request that the council authorize processing of the general plan amendment and the specific plan this evening. While the properties and the related projects are quite different, your authorization this evening will allow for a comprehensive review of these proposals and the ability to identify major components of infrastructure that would be needed to support these land uses, and this would all be via the specific plan itself. It will obviously also allow the applicants to and the property owners to better define and refine the individual projects. I have provided you with reductions of the exhibits that we presented at our neighborhood meeting on January 31st. I also do have copies of the question and answer session as well as other public comments should you like to review those as well. They're extremely helpful. While many of the council members were present at that meeting, needless to say, we were thrilled with the attendance and the participation, and more importantly, for the opportunity to hear firsthand what the neighbors' concerns, thoughts, opinions, and some kudos along the way as well. So we reached out this evening to make the neighbors aware of the meeting tonight, and we have initiated formation of a neighborhood subcommittee that would meet with the applicants outside of the more formal city process. So with your authorization tonight, the applicants will set about formalizing their applications, finalizing the draft specific plan, and working with staff to initiate the process as well as prepare the EIR. And speaking of that environmental document, as you know, that EIR will form the basis or the background for your decision-making process and cover a number of very important issues: traffic and circulation, water resources, wastewater disposal, ag resources and mitigation strategies, as well as aesthetics. While I know that there has been and there will continue to be questions asked and opinions offered about the project's specifics, there will be ample time for this discussion in the future as the applicants move through this process. So this evening, I want to thank you for your indulgence and look forward to your positive response and to initiating the general plan and specific plan amendment. We will, of course, be responsive to council's questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there questions from council on this? Kristen?
Carol, so next time you're in front of the city council, will that be for a formal application? Is that, I know you're going to go, I mean, I'm looking at the chart here, and I know you're going to go to Traffic Commission, ARC, the EIR, but the next time you're back in front of us will be for a formal application, is that right?
I believe so, and perhaps staff can help me with the details of that process, but we may be coming back to you to approve the contract for the EIR at that point.
Okay. But the reason I'm asking is because, you know, this is just sort of the very beginning of the whole process. I understand that. But if you're going to go through all this and then come back to us, a formal application, if there's any things that we should bring up now in regards to some of the project specifics, we wouldn't bring them up really now. I mean, I know we're not going to get into, like, the nitty-gritty, but just sort of some overall comments.
I think this is an opportunity, Councilwoman, to provide us direction as well. Granted, our request this evening is to authorize us to move forward in the process, but I would like to say that we're very open to your comments as well as to the public's comments. I don't know if I'll be able to respond to the comments adequately since we don't have an application before you this evening, but I'm good at taking copious notes, so I'm more than happy to take those comments.
Okay. Thank you for that. That's my only question for the applicant.
Any questions? Questions for the applicant?
Questions for the applicant staff? Are really more of the minutia details. I would like to know, there was discussion at the prior meeting in July about the during the pre-application process regarding emergency access, and at that time it was slated to go through the Japanese Cultural Center property. That was not how the decision was made, but I didn't really see in the plan where that actually was now located if it wasn't going through that property.
There actually will be a turnaround for emergency vehicles as you enter and go to the back toward the Japanese Welfare property. And then the Mangano Homes property as well has, if you will, a circular access in and out.
Okay. And then it also had to do, there was a reference in the staff report related to that there was going to be a reduction from 58 to 50 lots, yet in the conceptual design we really didn't have visual of where those lots would be taken from. The one that we got still had 60 lots indicated. So is that, have you gone that far yet with where those lots might be removed from?
The Mangano Homes design team is currently working through all the comments from the neighborhood as well as council comments from back in the summer of last year. And so, if you will, they're massaging that site plan, and they'll be responsive specifically to those comments.
Okay. That's very good to know. And then, again, this might be a little bit cart before the horse, so to speak, but unit size and unit price, have we gotten that far yet?
I think they're still working on the unit size, and I know that the pricing of things always comes up, and if I had a crystal ball, I could assist you with that, but I'm certain that, you know, they will be looking at the costs of homes in the immediate neighborhood, but as to the exact price of those, it would be very difficult. Realizing that this process in and of itself may take us well into toward the end of this year before we're coming back to you for a formal decision. Then construction documents are created, the map needs to be finalized, and then going into construction. So we could be looking at a three years out, which could dramatically change for the good or the bad what those prices
with just
might
all the different variables.
Exactly.
Okay, very good. And then I think the only other question or just a thought to put out there is there's concern about creek setback. There's concern about the configured lots up against the creek. And the question or thought that I had was, if you're going to be looking at reconfiguring eight lots, then is that an area where those eight lots could be reconfigured where it would address any concerns about the creek setback? And kind of taking that away a little bit if you're already going to be moving some parcels around. So that's, I think, more of a general comment too.
Yeah. And thanks for that. The Mangano Homes team, I think, is looking at all of the constraints and attributes of the site and attempting to work within those parameters, East Cherry on one side, the creek on the other side, property lines on the other side, and I have all faith in their team that they can make all those puzzle pieces work together.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I have a few questions, Mr. Mayor, and then I'll probably have questions for staff later on, and I may have questions for you later on as well if something comes up, but I think you know what my first question is probably going to be, and that is, It's my understanding that the Japanese Welfare Society doesn't believe they need to mitigate the loss of prime farm soil. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Certainly, I can just speak to the fact that they believe that it, because the property was never formally under ag production, it was zoned something else, then rezoned to ag. But that is their opinion, and that they also know that going through this process may have a different result as well. So they are fully aware of the changes that may occur as we move through the process.
Okay, and then I don't know if you've thought about this or if Andy's thought about it or Nick's thought about it, but what's the mechanism that you're going to use to hold the development rights once you do the mitigation on the other parcel?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
When you're mitigating somebody has to hold the development rights for the piece of property that you're using for the mitigation. So Nick's looking at a parcel, and those development rights have to be held by someone so that the land isn't developed. And I'm wondering if
correct.
You've thought
and
that
I think in
through.
Those cases that conservation easements, et cetera, aren't typically held by the jurisdiction, but they can be held by a nonprofit, by another conservation organization. I wish we were that far into the process to be able to tell you, but there are opportunities.
You're looking in that direction, something
yes.
like that. Okay, and then I don't know, are you... It seems a waste of time if we don't at least mention some concerns and issues with... even though we're at a very preliminary stage. So
I think we welcome that.
With your indulgence, I'd like to do that. Could one of you guys put the map up that shows all the different lots? Let me see if this pointer to work here. Let's not blind somebody while I'm at it there. Do you know how this thing works, Jim? Do you know how this thing works?
Yeah, it's working.
It's working. Let's see, where am I at here? I can't even see the thing. Is it there? I'm missing it. Anyway, I'm going to turn this thing off because I don't know what I'm doing. The internal roadways, what's the absolute distance from one side to the other? Not the rear loading homes, but the other. Yeah. What's the absolute distance between the two?
You know, I'm going to ask Mr. Mangano if he could help me with that level of detail, Councilman Brown.
Oh, push on the red arrow. Oh, look at that. Look at that. I actually have a college degree. You'd never know
it. Mr. Mayor, members of the council, Andy Mangano of Mangano Homes. That's probably, those home sites are about 50 to 60 feet wide. So how many home sites do we have there?
No, that's not really my question. My question is, what's the absolute width between one side of the road to the other?
Oh, it would be a standard city street width.
What's that?
Well,
I don't know. That means
30,
a lot of different
things. Matt, is that 32 feet or 36 foot right away?
Because I've heard 11-foot travel lanes. I've heard all different.
Well, I mean, they would be considered standard or so, right-of-way streets.
So right
I
now,
mean, the traffic engineer would.
So Allen Street right now, like I'm one street over. It's 24 foot across. Are you going to be? You're telling me you're going to be wider than 24 feet across?
If I may, Councilman Brown, envisioned in this very preliminary plan, it would probably be a 36 to 40 foot right of way, but
yeah.
That would include travelway and parkway and sidewalks and one side parking.
So that'd give you probably 22 to 24 feet of pavement area.
And so you'll have one side parking.
Yes.
And then where approximately is your guest parking within the project? Because you can't use street, you can't count street parking for your guest parking. That's public right-of-way.
The calculations have been made. I don't have them
can you
in
show
my
me
back pocket, but
show me
what I'm told by RRM engineers that we meet code.
Okay. Well, I don't know what that means. Can you show me on this map where your guest parking is?
Well, we're parking in front of each home or on one side of the house, and then we have the two parking spaces in the driveways. So I've been, you know, you, Tim, I've been told that we meet the code. I
understand. That's really general.
Right.
I need to try to be more specific for my own well-being. When you say two parking spots per home, does that mean in the garage or does that mean driveway space?
Driveway space.
So there'll be garages and driveways?
Yes.
Beautiful. And then I'm assuming this right here, this connection is for the Fredericks?
Is that? Yes, that's something that staff required of us to make a connection that would tie into some future street design.
Okay, so then let's go to Cherry itself. What's the staff had a concern about widening the road because of the jag up here, if I remember correctly. What's the ultimate width going to be?
We're going to need to do a traffic study, and that was really a topic of conversation at the neighborhood meeting. And I guess what we can say to you, we don't know what that design will end up being, but as far as we're concerned, we'll do whatever the city and the neighborhood wants us to do. So if you want it to be parking both sides, you don't want it to be parking both sides. If you want it to be larger, smaller, I think that's going to be a discussion, studied, Tim, so that we're fine with whatever. So
what you're saying is you're flexible
yes.
on the width of this. Looks like it's pretty well covered if you've got parking on at least one side. That's great. And then these back-loaded homes.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Alley-loaded. Mm-hmm.
What's the width of that right there?
The alley, I think, is 20 feet.
So garbage trucks or whatever can get in there?
Right.
Okay.
And what's not shown is that one street to the right goes all the way out now to, this is an old site map, goes all the way out to Cherry.
Okay.
So there's for fire safety. And
beautiful. Thank you so much. Mr. Mayor, those are my questions.
Any other questions?
I have a couple, I guess.
Go ahead, Kristen.
I was going to just when I go to my comments, I was just going to sort of make some notes. But just a quick question, just because I maybe it's there. It's not on the sheet in here that shows the frontage of Cherry that goes. I think it's number 6. I numbered it. When you look at the monument sign on Cherry, it shows a landscaped frontage a lot further down Cherry than where your property is, Andy. So are you going to be doing improvements all the way down? Is that?
No, I think that's for the specific plan design guidelines, and that'll be on the Dorfman property. So
right.
It also would be on the little park area that we're proposing, and then that design guideline will go all the way down to traffic.
Okay, so the improvements will, I knew it would be in front of the park because that's your property, but this is
right.
Because of the whole specific plan, so you'll
correct.
Take that same treatment, whatever you do, all the way down.
Right, I mean, we won't do it with our project, but
right.
It'll be a specific plan guideline that would
right.
have to be done with the Dorfman's development.
Okay, eventually.
Yes.
Okay. I think those are my only questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. I have a couple questions. Possibly staff can help. Just confusion on the summary of properties existing and the proposal where the acreages don't are not the same. For example, subarea 1 is listed as 6/10 of an acre on the existing and. Just by inspection, it looks, the photos, it looks bigger than that to me, more like the 2.1 that is in the proposal. So I was just confused about that, why the lot size or the acreage overall sizes are different, and what is actually accurate there.
Part of the reason is that we have our own GIS that we're dealing with, and so we have what we know to be true, and then we have information that the applicant is submitting, and then there's land going from one subarea to another subarea. So overall, the property is roughly 15 acres, and all of those little details we worked out when they come with a formal proposal.
Okay. And I did attend the neighborhood meeting that the applicants had, and a lot of questions I think were answered at that time, which is appreciated. No other questions. Is there a public comment on this item?
Thank you for listening.
Thank you.
My name is Cindy Fear, and I live at 317 East Cherry. And I don't know if the project will go beyond what we're seeing, because I recall from the 1990s there was a lot of battle over the Williamson Act and the alluvial soil, so, but whatever. Should it continue, I do have some concerns that I would like to bring to your attention, and I think Mr. Brown brought some. Should it go through, I would like to see a widening of Cherry Avenue between Traffic Way and Pacific Coast Railway Place. Any feet added to the width of the street will be absorbed by the new development, and parking on both sides is most desirable. I don't know if it's possible, but we've dealt without having parking for a long time. And then that jag you were talking about, from narrow to wider, it's just goofy. And then regarding safety, there's like where Cherry Avenue has a stop sign at Pacific Railway. And the cars, the motorists stop there, and then they gun it, and they zoom down the street. So what I would like to see there is one of the flashing lights like they have on Fair Oaks across from the Donut Delight, because there are a lot of kids that live on the street, and I'm just concerned about their safety, and I think some way of maybe slowing that traffic down would be great. And I like what was done down the street between Cherry Avenue and Branch Mill. Well, that can't be right. But between, like, the ones that go down, and there's the new one where they have the wall, like the, I don't know what the wall, but there's a separation wall, and then they have, like, the water-tolerant plants and the walkway. That's what I would like to see happen all the way down, so there's continuity from, like, within the neighborhood, so it's not kind of hodgepodgey put together or whatever. And I think it would be cool if there was an off-street bike lane incorporated with a meandering walkway to kind of encourage a walkable neighborhood where... Right now, when you're walking on the sidewalk, the cars are rushing by, like, right there. And maybe you're walking, and I'll see families going with kids on bikes and strollers, and it's just scary. It's scary to watch, and so I would like those things to be considered. And I really like what was done down the street, and that's kind of what I would like to see, should it go through. And I get kind of fumbled, so... appreciate your patience with me. And then I kind of drew what I kind of thought in my feeble way on this side, and that looks great, you know, where the entryway is. I, after listening to what was shared, I am a little concerned about fire access and how they would have to weave around, so, you know, to help anybody within that neighborhood should it be developed. So that's it, and I appreciate all of you looking at it and watching it and trying to hear the residents and what their concerns are. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Would anyone else like to speak to this item?
Yeah, my name is Charles Ross, and I live at 323 East Cherry. And actually, I'd like to see no development at all whatsoever. I think it's ill-advised to amend the general plan. A plan for a so-called specific plan. It's been agricultural property for as long as I've lived there, and it's people have made good use of that, and I hate to see it go. That's my feelings.
Thank you. Anyone else?
Linda Osti again from 309 East Cherry. I'd like to thank the mayor and the council members. I'd also like to thank the applicant.
And I'd like to thank him for inviting us to the meeting and to kind of review some of the things that we talked about and some of our concerns. I, too, would kind of would enjoy seeing it as ag, but I know that we keep going through development after development proposal, and eventually it's going to happen, but at least they're going to listen to us, and maybe we'll get some of the things that we need. On September the 9th in 2014, the following issues, conditions, and concerns experienced each day by the residents were presented to the council. On October 15th of 2014, the same issues, conditions, and concerns were presented again to the Traffic Commission. On November 15th of 2014, the same issues, concerns, were presented to the city engineer, the police chief, and were endorsed by 99% of the residents and other neighboring street residents. In addition, a concept street plan to resolve the safety issues and improvement conditions. The current issues, conditions, and concerns, each day we experience excessive speeding, no law enforcement present to enforce the posted speed limit, except for, I have to tell you, I did see a police officer out my driveway a couple times last week or week before last, so thank you guys. Having to back out of into traffic safety, into substandard travel lanes, accessing mailboxes and trash containers with safety, it's nearly impossible to check your mailbox with the traffic going by. Backup traffic behind garbage cans, school buses, mail trucks, unsafe passing conditions into oncoming traffic, unsafe passing to the right onto the dirt shoulder, and aggressive passing on the left into oncoming traffic by vehicles behind residents slowing down to turn into resident driveways. Safety for pedestrians while walking from dust and debris thrown by the passing vehicles within 2 feet of the curb and gutter. Safety for parents and their children who have to park on the south side of the street and cross the street to board the morning bus. And pets, we've seen dogs hit and killed on Cherry Street because of the traffic. Safety for children and adult bike riders, runners, and walkers, children and elders who utilize East Cherry Avenue going to school and group exercise. Environmental issues concerning excessive noise from the semi-trucks hauling farm equipment and produce. Of course, we like those. Full-size trucks and extra-wide trailers and all vehicles emitting greenhouse gas emissions and our air quality from the dust. This one-quarter-mile stretch of road by its length encourages speeding. The consensus of the future development of the ag field between Traffic Way and Pacific Coast Railroad south of East Cherry. The consensus presented to the City Council on February 10th of this year. The four most important issues which directly affect the neighborhood by the proposed development on the south side of the street of East Cherry. Number one, widening of the street to provide safe ingress and egress into the travel way from the north side of the residence driveways. Number two, keep the speed limit to 25 miles per hour. Number three, a landscape garden wall similar to the wall at the 500 and 600 blocks of East Cherry Avenue. I think that's the Coker Ellsworth development. Number four, no housing fronting East Cherry Avenue. Number five, no two-story homes fronting East Cherry Avenue. And number six, no development of the agricultural properties keeping existing zoning. So those are the things we brought up, and thank you for listening to me.
Thank you. Anyone else? Karen.
Karen White, Village of Halcyon, speaking for myself and nobody else tonight. You might as well give them their building permits tonight. It looks like a totally done deal. I think it's another example of your smart growth. I live geographically downwater from this development. There's a Cherry floodplain. There's a Los Barrios floodplain. That goes into the Rio Grande Creek, which turns at Halcyon and Highway 1. Where if it floods, they'll blow out the creek channel and flood the entire part of the lower valley. Every time you pave something, the risk of flooding gets higher. Beyond that, I don't think with your new plans for smart growth and the other things you've done, I don't think you have any regard for Roy Grandy's history of agriculture. The best use of that piece of property is probably a small truck farm with a farmer's market. You'd make just as much money as the houses and you wouldn't produce slum. You know, you shouldn't go forward at all until you have an agricultural mitigation plan. You shouldn't give them an inch to get through the door so they can come back later and say, you told us we could do it. The Board of Supervisors has fought that. You guys have fought that. Don't give them anything until you know how they're going to mitigate the ag land, till you know how they're going to mitigate the flooding, till you know how they're going to widen the roads. Because once you say yes, it's yes. You know, you have let developers get away with everything. I still am mad at Arroyo Grande for the beautiful development that is just outside my community at the Pike and Elm Street. Have you driven past there? You wouldn't make any efforts to protect Halcyon sustainable agricultural land right across the street from that high-density, smart-growth development. We're planning, if at all possible, to put a three-strand barbed wire fence around our cemetery because you've offered it no protection. You don't look to the neighbors. You just look to what you can do to develop Arroyo Grande. I've only lived here 77 years. I know a lot of things that have been done incorrectly. And I think until you know a lot more about this one, you shouldn't say yes to anything. Thank you.
Thank you. Please, come on. Patty.
Patty Welsh, Arroyo Grande. I also went to the meeting that Mr. Magano held out on Cherry. I like the development. I got to say, I like it a lot more now that it's not going through the Japanese gardens. But I was glad to see a builder so willing to work with the residents in the area. I found that very refreshing. And basically, I like the project. Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Robert Johnson. I live at 277 East Cherry, and I've been before the board before, the council before. And today, I just like, Linda was up and she was talking about the plan, so I'd like to read something into the record. The plan that we have presented to the city, the plan design will provide an essence of livability associated with the surrounding neighborhood environment, a sense of well-being, be aesthetically pleasing, social activities will increase, and with the traffic management scheme, bring a perception of street safety and an effective way to reduce speeds without compromising safety, and improve traffic circulation for pedestrians and vehicles traffic. This plan was formulated based upon the submittal, the pre-submittal or pre-draft submittal, and I was able to sit down and in my window in my house, and I look right across the street from it, and I'm able to put some things together. One thing I really like to address right now, though, is the characteristics of East Cherry Avenue. It's a designated collector street by a 2001 general plan, master plan. It's a future Class 2 bicycle route as part of the city's bicycle and trails master plan. Currently, it's substandard in comparison to other village streets and per street improvement standards. It's a primary route for by emergency vehicles by the neighboring residents, resident developments. It has all the characteristics of being a perpetual easement, an ingress and egress easement, a non-exclusive easement, a prescriptive easement, a statutory easement, and implied dedication. When trespassing is done by the public, a right of use is created when the owner allows the city to make improvements or maintain a portion of the owner's land. A public dedication is created. The above characteristics, East Cherry Avenue, should be considered a separate parcel, separate sub-parcel, with its own specific design standards and development requirements. To establish the street right-of-way boundary based upon the above characteristics and neighborhood safety, it is suggested the widening of the street be placed on an agenda to dedicate by resolution, city council resolution. I'd like to go on and say To note, the applicant has recognized the existing conditions and concerns by the residents of East Cherry Avenue by widening the street improvements from previous width of 58 feet to 64 feet. The applicant proposed land criteria is 60 lots on 13.26 acres. This is based on open boundaries, which include the JVA properties of 1.5 acres. That's where he gets his 60 lots that's depicted up here. The JVA, in perspective, the JVA property has been brought into the specific plan primary for rezoning from agricultural to a public facility designation and to honor the Japanese community. The JVA proposal of November 25, 2014 does not include subdivision of property into lots. The applicant property the applicant property of 11.7 acres is made up of portions of lot 88 and 91. The north boundary line is 6 feet south of our existing curb on the north side of East Cherry. East Cherry Avenue, formerly Leadham, has served the community before 1867 and is shown on Woods Edition track map recorded in 1887 as 16 feet wide. The current improvements and utilities were constructed in 1973 by the City Public Works Department. Plans are on file with the city engineer. The physical roadway section is 46 feet, 34 feet being on the applicant's property, consisting of approximately 7/10 of an acre. In summary, review of the applicant's proposal, exclusive of the Japanese Welfare Association property, the deed area of the applicant is 11.7. Development area for the subdivision of lots per the general plan land use element LU2-4.1 allows a maximum density of 4.5 dwelling units per acre within a single family residence, medium density designation. The 11.7 is equated to 53 lots. If you take out the half an acre that's going to be dedicated for the parking lot that's there, that brings to 11.2, and that allows 50 dwelling units based upon the standards. Then with a minimum of minus 7/10 of acreage of East Cherry Avenue by implied dedication, the net area for calculation of the number of dwellings per acre is 10.5 acres, and that produces 47 dwellings. Minus 1 acre for reserve for an emergency access easement and pedestrian perimeter walkway and the drainage easement on the rear of the site. Equates to 9.5 acres, which would allow only 43 dwelling units. The applicant proposes exhibits. Well, I don't even want to get into that. That has something to do with me. Anyway, so I'd just like to say that I've had time to sit down with this, and I've had some background in land development, and so I've been able to help the neighborhood and participate and want to make sure that the north boundary of this street is done before he decides to do his development. I think it's most important that the boundaries are set, then he knows exactly what he can develop. And primarily, my main concern, too, is that we have a perimeter pedestrian walkway that perimeters all the way around the site, which allows fire trucks to get in there and protect that the creek bed, but all the brush and the trees that are existing there, and to protect the homes up there on Trinity. So the idea is it can be developed, and he can still get in approximately 50 homes if he goes with a minimum of 55 square foot homes, not including the street, and that will allow him to, the perimeter path. It would also allow for on-site parking. It would allow for parks. It would allow for 50-foot wide streets. It would work out okay if he would, really concentrate on what his boundaries are. Also, I think that a turnout would be a thing to look out to on East Cherry Avenue. Right now, we're restricted with parking on our side of the street because of the driveways and because of the jog in the road at Pacific Railway. But if we would put in a median on the south side, would be on his side of the property. You turn in, he would be able to have parking on his side of the street, but we would also have parking where we're parking now. So that would allow everyone to have maybe 20 parking spaces each. So it would, if he sits down with the development, he can work these things out. So right now, like I say, my primary concern, or my only concern, is the welfare of the street and the safety of, you know, of our residents on that street. So it's hard for me to talk. So anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you. Would anyone else like to address this particular item? Shirley.
Hello, Shirley Gibson Halcyon, and I'm here for my mother, Minetta Bennett, and she lives at 415 Allen Street. So I think there are some existing traffic problems that really aren't the responsibility of whatever happens with this development. On the corners of East Cherry and Traffic Way and Allen and Traffic Way are both death traps. Low visibility, it's hard to turn right, let alone turn left. And the guy with the service station, he's great, he does a dynamite business, but that's a big bottleneck because there are so many cars parked every which way and dropping off and picking up cars. And it's a problem area. So I'd like to see the city deal with those intersections, let alone whatever happens with this development. I also would like to see what the ag land mitigation is, what is being proposed before the city makes any moves. I think it is the job of the council to protect the public and to make sure that you take the time now to be careful and see that you're making the right choices. I'm worried about the density and the narrowness of the street and whether there's adequate parking, and my list kind of goes on. So thank you for your time.
Thank you. Would anyone else like to address this item? Okay, hearing none. Council comment?
I have a question for staff.
Okay, let's start with Council Member Guthrie.
I guess I'll start with in one of the one of the things that was handed to us by the public, they did refer to some car counts on Cherry Avenue, and I know I asked you yesterday if we had more recent car counts than that we had done. I just wanted to hear if you have those numbers, what they are.
Yeah, unfortunately, I do not have those numbers in front of me now. They won't be apples to apples given timing of counts. However, we do have some proximate counts that were taken with a different project, and I can't say whether they validate the counts that were given to us by neighbors, and would just like to emphasize that once the formal application comes in, once it's deemed complete, then that's the existing condition for the project going forward, and then the counts for the required traffic and circulation study would be the ones we would have to use. But I don't think, just in general, that the average daily trips that are being proposed as proximate counts are far off. It's a busy collector street just by virtue of fringe development on the outskirts.
Okay. And just for the public, I think that was roughly 1,000 yeah. Kind of car. Well, that's all right. It was roughly 1,000 cars a day. Yeah, 2,000. All right. Stand corrected. The other question I have has to do with this question about the creek, because we went through the discussion in one of the previous pre-applications about the the creek or the drainage ditch, or however you want to identify it, across the back of this property. We had significant discussion about it now. It's not drawn up nearly as well here in these as it was at that time. So I would like to hear, maybe you can recap what the last discussion was. I know we're new council, new discussion, but I do think it warrants some review.
Sure. The drainage area runs to the south of the property, and it conveys some of the drainage from the Newsom Springs area. The previous pre-application, Kelly can correct me, there's some discussion about making sure there is city's requirement for creek setback was required in the development, which would be 25 feet in this case, because it's a minor drainage. There was lots of discussion on how that would be, could be embraced in the design of the development, if you will. It's very difficult in this case because obviously there's rarely any water there, so it's sort of it's not an aesthetically pleasing creek you want to incorporate into a development. And nonetheless, it conveys water at, and very importantly, in some storm events, some significant storm events, and is an important feature to make sure that remains in the development. Our creek setback policies encourage not these drainages not to be piped, to be open drainages for various reasons, not only to convey water, but to recognize opportunities for habitat and so forth. The pre-application discussion included whether the creek setback should include a pathway and alongside the drainage, and the issues there were that they would be immediately against some backyards that were being, in the conceptual development at the time, not unlike what you see before you. And the concern was that it wouldn't be very visible, and there could be some safety concerns if you have a pathway along a backyard fence, and maintenance issues and safety concerns related to that. So that's sort of it's my recollection of the previous discussion.
Okay. Thank you. I don't have any other questions. I don't know if you want to finish questions or go directly through comments or...
Questions first, I guess, if we had additional.
I had one question. Nick, could you comment on, are you prepared to comment on any ag mitigation land that you're looking at?
Good evening. We are fully aware and of the ag mitigation requirements, have identified the property, have acquired it, and for a couple of reasons, I have no problem. We've shared it with staff. We've asked that it's a confidential thing for now, but it is a piece of property. It's Class 1 soil. It's an ag operation. And it also may have some other strategic benefits for the community in terms of walking paths and connectivity to other parts of the community, or something that seem like they could potentially be integral. And so we are fully committed to meeting our obligations on that and have the property.
Okay, and so it's in the city limits.
Yep.
And it's you've closed escrow. You own
yep,
it.
Yep, we own it.
Thank you for that. I have no more questions.
Barbara?
For me, thank you.
Tim, any others?
Yeah, thank you. My first question, Teresa, maybe you can help me with this. When we adopted the ag mitigation policy way back when, I can't remember it ever being used until now. It seems to me this is actually the first legitimate use of the ag mitigation policy. Is that correct?
The only other property I could think of was when we were looking at Castillo del Mar Road Extension Project, and there was a small piece of ag property there that we that required mitigation.
But when we did the other property farther down Cherry that was converted, that didn't need to, at the time, didn't need to actually be mitigated, if I remember correctly.
That's correct. It went from residential zoning to residential zoning.
Okay.
I think it's Karen. Is that your name, ma'am? She brought up the issue of, you know, not getting ahead of the game in terms of...
not getting ahead of the game. Sorry, I thought my mic was off. In terms of the ag mitigation, now Nick says he owns the property, which gives me great comfort. He's not in the middle of trying to negotiate it still. Can we condition the zoning change based on the mitigation being completed first? In other words, can we actually put in there that we'll allow the general plan amendment, if that's what we choose to do, pending complete resolution of, like I mentioned earlier, the mechanism that it's held, all that? I'd like to see all that in place before we do the general plan amendment.
Before a general plan amendment or any subdivision can occur on this property, that ag impacts have to be addressed through environmental review. And in our code, those mitigation requirements must be described and conditioned on that, on the property, on the project. So tonight, you're looking at a pre-application. There's no project you're approving tonight. Even should you go forward with authorizing the applicant to go forward with a project, you're not approving a project at this time.
Or the amendment itself.
Correct. That's
okay.
Correct.
Thank you. Those are all my questions right now, Mr. Mayor.
I have no questions at this time, so we can move into discussion.
Well, I guess I'll start with sort of what I'll think of some of the more global issues, and one of them is, of course, ag mitigation. I am glad to hear that we have at least the makings of something that is sort of at the top of the priority list, which is inside the city, and I assume acre for acre. So we'll deal with that when it comes forward. It is a requirement of the general plan amendment. So it all happened at the same time. The other deal is I'm going to say the overall water picture. Certainly, as was mentioned by a couple of people at the neighborhood meeting, how can we be going into a where we're restricting water use for everyone else and then are going to allow even more homes? I'll say that there's two pieces of that. One is there's a significant amount of water being used today, probably far more water than would be used by the residential facility, or by the residential designation. So we would probably net water anyway, but that's something that will be part of that review. And on top of that, if in fact we're in some, you know, if we're down to, I'm always getting backwards, but I think it's stage two where we're down to everybody's 55 gallons a day, then there'll probably be some other moratorium or restriction in place on this kind of a project. So on that much larger issue, it's separate from what we're really looking at tonight. If we're in fact in that situation with water, we'll be dealing with it on many levels, not just this level. So I think sort of on the micro level here of water, I would expect that we would actually net water on this project in our, certainly we'd net a significant amount of water probably in what's taken out of the groundwater basin today compared to what would be taken out of water by the residential facility. But even in the much broader gentleman's agreement that we all have about how much water the city's entitled to from groundwater, we would probably come out ahead of that. But again, that's actually a much longer process. We wouldn't know that on the day that we approve it, but we would know it at some point down the line. But we would certainly have from the CEQA work to know that we are not actually using more water today after this, if it is approved, is in place than it was before. The other sort of global issue, I think, is the circulation question at Traffic Way and Cherry. And I'm glad to hear someone say that isn't the fault or the responsibility of this development, but it is, in fact, it is a fact of what's going on at that area. And I'm not sure whether the service station was the mobile station or whether it's the replayer station across the street
there on Cherry. But certainly we all know that everybody's coming off the freeway too fast there. And I did check with staff. This is part of our circulation. New circulation elements come in is specifically to address this issue here. And there's a number of ways of dealing with it, but I do want to point out it's not easy to deal with when we're dealing with Caltrans, and anytime you're dealing with Caltrans, it's problematic. But on top of that, this is naturally, the traffic way is very broad at this point. I think any of the mitigations that will reduce speeds on traffic way at this point are going to be controversial. I'll just put it that way, because in order to slow down those cars, those people aren't going to want to slow down either. So there's two sides to every story, I guess is what I would say. But I think, again, that particular piece of the circulation is beyond this development. This development is not going to contribute significantly to that problem, because the problem really is the speed of the cars coming off the freeway. It'll add traffic to that corner, but it won't significantly change it. Getting down to the specifics of Cherry Lane, I do think we want to see parking on both sides, which is relatively wide road. But the catch-22 is, as soon as you widen the road, you increase the speeds. Mm-hmm. So I think parking on both sides helps, as long as everybody is parking. As long as you actually have parked cars there, then the road appears narrow. But as long as cars aren't parked there, I live on a street very much like this. Hardly anybody parks in the street. And everybody drives really fast on my residential street, because it's a drag strip. It's just wide open. Naturally drive fast. So I do think that parking wide enough to park on both sides is key for two reasons. One is certainly you want the parking on the one side. I don't know that there's that many parking spaces available on the north side of the property when you look at all the driveways. I mean, I roughly counted that there would only be seven, but, you know, depending on how you know better than I do, there's not that many parking spaces. And so I actually think a better way of dealing this is, rather than the other disadvantage of parking is that it's going to make it, when you start talking about backing out into the roadway, then catch-22 slows down the cars. It also blocks your view. So I really think the way to deal with this is probably with a couple of bulb outs at some point, which also create, I think, pedestrian crossing zones. I think the comment that was made about putting the flashing light but also then to reduce the width of the road based on having these bulb outs there, I think will be one of those traffic calming things that could work here. So that would just be a possible direction to go. But I think this is doable. I think that we can provide parking, which we absolutely have to do, and that we can find a way to slow down the traffic on this road from what it is today. It certainly will not be faster, I don't believe. Getting back to the general density issue, I believe, and this actually should have been a question, but I believe density includes all the drive. When you start talking about density per acre, you're talking about includes all the roads and all of the sidewalks and all of those things anyway, so we wouldn't be taking that out of their calculation. I'd also point out that this is one of the reasons this is a specific plan is that you do I live in an area with very smaller lots like this, 5,000 square foot lots, which works really well in my opinion, but when you do this, that I will say this is the new, what I'll call the new norm, is to go to really higher density looks, not just because of the financing of it, but because of it uses less water. It's just much better use of bringing more density in closer to operations and reducing circulation issues in general. So I think the density is probably in line here. I do think there's difficulty, which we'll need to work out on how to deal with runoff and all of those kinds of issues. Get back to the slides here. The one comment I had to do with was, I noticed in one of the neighborhood plans is to put up the wall along the whole length of, and I personally don't have a strong feeling about it either way, but personally I don't think walling off any neighborhood is a good idea. Mm. Again, in my neighborhood we have an example of what was in one of the plans, which was to have the front of the homes, you know, where you park behind, you have the front that happens to be right next door to where I live. It's not used that much, partly because of road gradient, but still most people enter their home from their garage or from where they park. So even though so for two reasons. One is that it's aesthetically more pleasing. It's bringing this neighborhood together instead of having homes on the street on one side and a walled-off community on the other. I think it's just far better, in, especially in somewhere that we call the village, that this would be a much better alternative. I noted the concern about two-story homes, and we have many times in the past accommodated when you have one-story homes backing up to, this is where your backyard to backyard, we've often accommodated by reducing to single level the first row of homes so that if you have single home on one side of your backyard, you have single home single on the other side, and the rest of the development may be two-story. But this is across the street. In fact, it's across what's going to be what probably will end up being a 50-foot right-of-way, so it's very far across the street that you're going from what is predominantly single-story homes to two-story homes. So I don't feel a necessity to restrict the building height on that side of the street. I think that it can be worked out, and it'll have minimal impact on the neighbors across the street because you do have the full width of the street here. I give you a couple of examples. We did this in Park Place. Most of the homes there are two-story, but they were backyard to backyard. We did a single story, but in other neighborhoods where they're across the street, we've definitely gone with two stories. Yeah, I do have some concerns about how the creek. We went through the whole creek discussion. We don't have the pictures here today. This isn't really a creek. It is a drainage area. It isn't a creek, and it's also been significantly changed by when we put in the Newsom Springs drainage. And I didn't want to get into a big discussion about that, but we've changed significantly the amount of water that's necessary. And at the end of this ditch, I'm sorry, at the end of this creek or ditch, whatever we want to call it today, it is piped. It goes into a very small, relatively small drainage pipe. So at the end of the day, it doesn't matter how broad an area we have here. At the end, it all comes down to the size of the drain at the end of the property. And so I think that certainly the drainage area has to be adequate to deliver that much water. But I don't see this as a creek in the classic sense of the way that we think of a creek. That's all my comments for right now. Thank you.
Mayor Pro Tem.
Thank you. So I'll jump right into what Jim was talking about on the path behind the houses along the creek. I think that, my preference is, and back when we saw this before, was to use that real estate behind the houses and not have a path, but use it out in the development, because I think more people are going to use a path out in the development. It was meandering, it was wide, there were street trees, there was a parkway. Take that land and use it out there versus behind the houses, because even though I like the idea of a path along a creek, as Jim said, it's not necessarily a real creek. And then it doesn't really go anywhere, unfortunately, and I don't really think it really maybe in my lifetime will go somewhere. I think it might go to the Fredrickson's property this way eventually, but I just think it's better use of what's back there if we just use the land interior to the complex. So that would be my preference on that. And this is getting into some specifics, but I feel like I have to give this feedback because it's going to come back so long from now, and you're going to have gone through all these channels, and so I want to just give you sort of some thoughts. On the wall that Jim talked about, and it's been brought up a couple times in the information that some people have given to us, I'm not at all for that wall. I think it really blocks. It says we're in here and we're not part of the village. I think to sort of welcome people to the neighborhood, the houses need to face Cherry just like the other houses face Cherry. That's sort of an old-fashioned 50s neighborhood. I think that's the feel we want. And even though I do like the treatment of the wall that's further down with the landscaping, it does look nice. Along the farmland, it was probably appropriate, but then, right on Cherry, I don't think that really works for a welcoming, aesthetically pleasing frontage. The second story versus the single story, like Jim said, it's going to be a very wide street. So I think, you have some depictions here, some architectural renderings of what Cherry might look like with a second story and a first story and a second story. And I think that that's a nice mix. I think there are second stories that are along Cherry as well. If you did all two stories, maybe not. But I think if you vary them, I think that that's okay. I think that looks fine. And they're not real close to the neighbors across the street, so that should be fine. The issues on the road, I was going to bring this up as well, is I'm all for widening it and improving it, but I don't want it to be so wide, like Jim said, that if we don't have people parking there, it's going to look really wide. And I live on a dead-end street that's wide on Canyon Way. People go like 50 because no one parks on our street. And it's really wide, and it's a dead end, and people fly. So this actually goes somewhere. So I'm afraid if we widen it, people don't park there, people are going to go even faster. So it does, when you widen a street, people do go faster. They do. If you have cars parked there, and you have bike lanes, and you have the parkways and the sidewalks, it encloses it, and then people slow down. But so I'm all for widening it. I just want to make sure that we don't cause people to drive faster down the street, because I think we want people to go 25. And the bulb outs and the parkways, I think those are really good ideas to reduce speed on that street. I'm glad, I appreciate that Mr. Tompkins has gone out and secured a piece of property that's within the city limits. I think that's exactly what we're looking for, and that it's closed escrow, and I'm happy to see that. I think those are all my comments. Okay with moving forward tonight with the general plan amendment and the specific plan. Obviously, there's so many other things we need to look at. We need to look at the EIR. We need to look at all the traffic counts, the water, all of that. And I'm going to be interested to look into depth at all that information that we get back. But going forward tonight, I am happy to move forward with what's proposed. Thank you.
Councilmember Harmon.
Yes, thank you. I am very pleased to see that the effective neighborhood has been brought in early on in the process, and there's been, it seems like, a very positive exchange between the applicant and the affected neighborhood. So that's always a good thing when projects like this move forward. I'd also like to address the Japanese Cultural Center. I think it's an exceptional project. I think it'll be a tremendous historical attribute for our city and add to our city's, and also be such a benefit for our city's Japanese heritage. So it's just a shame we can't move forward on that one right away. All right. So with that being said, I do also support the architectural style that would be being considered. However, when I look at the conceptual plans, it seems like there are two specific styles that have been selected, with perhaps maybe more of what I would call slight changes in design elements. So maybe if a few more varieties of the bungalow, the craftsman, and instead of just having maybe two, do a combination of three, just to mix it up so it doesn't look so cookie cutter. And I certainly like the possibility of extending the what I would call the village appeal to this neighborhood, and then with connectivity, I can see that the Japanese Cultural Center would bring tourists that way, and so this project would be a very critical one to move forward on and to do it right. So it's nice that we're having a lot of dialogue on it. I also think the creating at least a preliminary access to the Frederick and Williams property could also be seen as an advantage to this project. Now for the reality check and some of the concerns. Everybody's already talked at length about the ag mitigation. It seems like that's being addressed. I'm also concerned about increased traffic. The high density of the housing and limited pedestrian pathways, at least at this point in the housing design plans. There are also, as indicated, traffic circulation issues. The width of East Cherry Street is too narrow. I think we have a consensus on that this evening. And also, water availability, given the current conditions and certainly our unknown water availability at the time the project actually moves forward to break ground, will have to be probably considered pretty routinely just based on availability. But with all of that said, given the uniqueness of the current property size, the location, and just pretty the infrequency, and maybe that's not fair, but the infrequency of the agricultural use at this point, I think weighing all of those factors, I would be able to move forward to support the general plan amendment through the specific plan process. Thank you.
Councilmember Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I want to first touch on the Japanese welfare parcel and the question that I asked Teresa earlier, and that was, when's the last time that we actually put the mitigation you know, into effect that we put in the general plan? And we really haven't done it. This is the first one out of the box. It's the first one out of the gate. So when I hear that there was an arson on their property and their cultural, you know, things were destroyed, I get angry as all get out. And I want to give them anything and everything they want. That's my natural reaction. They deserve to be made whole as much as we can and give them what they need, okay? So please understand my comments are couched in that idea. But I wonder what kind of precedent we're setting or what kind of motion we're setting in if we don't ask them to mitigate. And when people say, well, it was never farmed, people miss this argument a lot about why we mitigate. It's not just because it was previously farmed. It's not just about what the previous history was on the parcel. It has to do with the underlying soil. The underlying soil is fantastic, okay? We're going to give them a general plan amendment which allows them to do exactly what they want to do right now, which what they're doing is great. I have no problem with what they're doing, none whatsoever. This generation, I've already talked to Margaret, someday they're going to get tired and they're going to pass it on to the next generation. What happens then if they want to go in and put in high-density housing and they haven't mitigated for it? I just don't think that's reasonable. I could live with the idea that they could put in what they want now, and the proviso is that if the use changes, that they would mitigate at that point in time. I'd be willing to do that. That might be 10, 15 years down the road. Who knows? But I just think that parcel has to be mitigated just like the rest. It's only fair. It's only reasonable. And it's not that expensive, quite honestly. I had some just short discussions with Nick on what it would take to mitigate that parcel, and I don't think it would be that much. I think we could get it done. So I'm not really for the idea that the Japanese Welfare Society parcel shouldn't be mitigated. That being said, I'm going to move on to the other issues. Okay, let's see if we can get this thing to work now. The idea of putting bulb outs on this side of the street, like both Councilman Guthrie and Barnage talked about, is a really good idea. And I think the example that you can find, I think, Jim, would it be on Rodeo Drive? Or where's a good example? Rodeo, probably. Where you have these bulb outs. And what they would do, what they would allow you to do is give you more line of sight as you're backing out of your driveways, because there'd be more space. And it actually acts as a calming mechanism as well for people coming up and down the street. So despite the width of the street, if you had bulb outs, it creates the same idea of having a parked car there, even though you don't have places to park cars as much on that side of the road. So the idea of bulb outs, I think, is a fantastic idea on that side of the street. And I would want, I saw there was a bike lane. It makes me a little nervous if we don't have enough width on that side. I've seen bicycle accidents. I've seen all kinds of stuff there. Parking on this side is good. The idea of the wall is a fascinating issue for me, and I agree with both Councilman Guthrie and Barnage on the issue of the wall. only for this reason. I was around when we put the wall up for the other parcel, and the reason we did that was because it was an ag mitigation to create distance, artificial distance between the farmland and the homes, because they couldn't give a 100-foot buffer. So in lieu of doing a 100-foot buffer, they put a wall in. They didn't just put a wall in for a decorative issue. That being said, yeah, the wall's great and it's beautiful and all that stuff, but it had a specific purpose. And I think the idea behind the village is, again, to be inclusive. The only worry I have is, what are these homes going to look like facing the street? In other words, what aesthetically, what are we going to be seeing on this side? Is it going to be comparable to what we're seeing on this side, or is it going to be so completely different it's going to look unusual? Now, if it looks that unusual and that different from these homes, I'd be more inclined to put a wall there because it would stick out like a sore thumb. But if you can make it neighbor-like, and I've seen Andy's presentation, it shows these homes that look similar to, in fact, he had my own home in there, to these homes, but I don't know if that's what we're going to have in reality. So that's a question in my mind. I gave Andy a hard time about the guest parking, and I think I was really still thinking back to the project behind Cortland, where that really needed guest parking. This one is not the same thing if he's got parking on at least one side of the street and they have driveways. I think it's key that each home have driveways in addition to garages. If it's garages and they're 2 feet from the street, I can't go for that. But if it's got driveways that they can park their car, because people inevitably in small homes use their garages for storage, they're just going to do it, I'm probably okay with that. Regarding the drainage issue, Teresa, maybe you can help me with this, but a lot of the flooding and the water that came through that neighborhood right there and down there was from Newsom, got resolved with the Newsom Springs drainage, if I remember correctly.
It is to a large extent resolved with the Newsom Springs drainage project, in that the drainage was accommodated through the Cherry Creek development. Nonetheless, there's in the big storms, drainage will still need
but not nearly what it used to be. Okay, so I'm not as worried about that issue. I'm not even going to touch the Fredericks property. I'll get all excited and I'll be here all night, so I'm not going to do that. But other than that, Andy, I think it's a decent project. Nick, I appreciate your doing the mitigation because that's near and dear to my heart. There's a lot of people that have served on this council that worked hard to get that done, and this is the first real test of that policy. And so I do appreciate it. And in Karen's comments that we shouldn't allow the change until the mitigation is done, I agree with that. I think we should have the mitigation completely in place before we actually do the general plan amendment. In other words, the whole mechanism, everything would be done. And I think we still need to figure out some mitigation of some sort, even if it's minimal, for the Japanese Welfare Society. So those are my comments, Mr. Mayor.
Okay, several issues on this one. First, I'd like to thank the applicants for involving the community with the tent meeting and so forth and the notices early on in the project. I think that's much appreciated. The water is a big issue, obviously. I would presume that the environmental impact report will deal with water and the comparison between the existing agricultural use of water vice a residential development that's fitted for the latest low flow plumbing fixtures and so forth. Speed on the street is obviously a big issue. The street needs to be widened to allow parking, hopefully on both sides with bike lanes. The racetrack aspect of it today, in my opinion, is partly due to the vacant appearance of the agricultural land there, and I think that still bulb outs in the parking is a good idea, such that the active traffic lanes are don't appear to be the full width of the street, including the parking and the bike lanes. But I would think that speed can be reduced by techniques such as bulb outs. With respect to the wall, I tend to oppose the idea of a wall, again, for the reasons that several people have said previously. I don't think it lends to inclusiveness in the neighborhood. Also, the wall, I think, would tend to amplify, again, the kind of raceway aspect along the street, and I don't think that is something we want to encourage, whereas a more residential-looking frontage from the homes actually fronting on the street, I think would tend to naturally restrict speeds on the street. Ag mitigation is another major issue. I'm pleased to hear that the applicant has is prepared and understands the need for ag mitigation. With respect to the Japanese Welfare Association's proposed project there, it seems to me that their proposed project is largely agricultural, and I'm reminded that even farms and agricultural land have things like farmhouses, they have things like barns, they have things like corrals. So those buildings are agriculture-related, and they exist on farmland throughout the country. So I don't see that as the fact that there would be some structures there. I don't see that at all out of character with the general agricultural use. Perhaps the zoning could be such that Councilmember Brown suggested that a future restriction be placed so that it would maintain that character going forward and not be turned around for, you know, some major project in the future. I think the applicant would probably be okay with that, and I certainly respect the designs that they have. One other thing going forward is the provision for the increased fire protection impact, police impact, street maintenance impact on the city going forward. So I want to make sure that the provisions for that are all spelled out. But in general, I tend to favor the project. So those are my comments on it. Please do.
Teresa, what about the item that Tim's talking about? Could we put a clause somewhere that if this property, the Japanese Welfare Association property, later on was developed in something, you know, obviously residential, I don't know how we, it would be maybe too much of a gray area, I'm not sure, that they would have to mitigate for it if it's substantially different than what's proposed now, which I'm okay with. I think it fits, but what are your thoughts on that?
I think at this time it's very good to get those comments into the record in terms of going forward with processing a general plan. But to make a call on whether that's adequate mitigation, I think is premature. Really, that has to be addressed through CEQA and through the EIR process. So given that there's some flexibility in the language for the, in our municipal code for what is what can constitute or what the requirements are for ag mitigation, I think it's good to get council's take on that at this stage, but and putting that into the record for this meeting, it would be important. But to make that call of whether that's going to be adequate or not, really has to be ferreted out in the CEQA process.
We can always comment on it later when the EIR comes back.
Absolutely.
We can change it there.
Certainly.
Okay, thank you for that.
I have a follow-up based on what you said. I guess I'm confused a little bit about the process, because if we allow the general plan amendment to go forward now, we've basically concluded that there is no mitigation necessary.
I think really the key word here is authorizing the processing of a general plan, and I think that's really the question before you this evening. Going forward and allowing the applicant to submit an application for a general plan amendment is what you're authorizing at this time, certainly not the general plan amendment itself.
Okay, gotcha. Sorry, you told me that before, and I think I'm so uptight about losing the mitigation. I think it just goes over my head sometimes.
Any more comment, or does anyone want to make a motion?
Well, I'll move that we authorize staff to move forward with a general plan amendment for the said property. Since my screen is dead.
And specific plan.
Second.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded that we approve the staff recommendation, which is to review the authorized processing of a general plan amendment and specific plan for the proposed project. May I have a roll call, please?
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Barnidge?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Councilmember Harmon?
Yes.
And Mayor Hill?
Yes. Okay, I've been asked for a short break, so let's take a break until 8 p.m. That's approximately 8 minutes. Okay, we're returning from the break,
right.
And I'll ask the city clerk to introduce the next item, please.
Yes. Item 11B is consideration of fiscal year 2014-15 mid-year budget report.
Director Malicote, you have the report.
Good evening, Mr. Mayor, members of the council. I'm Debbie Malicote. I'm your Director of Administrative Services, here tonight to talk about the mid-year budget report. The purpose of the mid-year budget report is to take a snapshot in time of how we're performing about halfway through the year, to update the budget with audited results from the prior fiscal year, now that the audit is complete. It also provides us an opportunity to report to the council how the departments are doing in accomplishing the goals that were identified in the 2013-15 biennial budget. And although we do look at all the operations and all of the funds in the city, the mid-year report really has a general fund focus. Just a few key points. Overall, revenues are recovering in all major categories, which is, again, the same information I provided to you last year, so I think we are definitely well underway in the recovery from the recent economic downturn. The fund balance is strong and is projected to equal 27% of the expenditure appropriations at year end. The council has a policy of 15% and a goal of 20%, so an actual of 27 is a very favorable result. There are a few budget adjustments that are needed. Most of them are to the positive. And I'm happy to report that departments are making good progress in achieving the goals that were identified in the budget. Quick look at the top 10 revenues. The trends are consistent with the prior year in that Although we're halfway through the year, we're only 39% collected, and that's because not all of our revenue comes in equal 1/12 increments every month. For example, the two that you see that are zeros, they're the triple flip for vehicle license fees and the triple flip for sales tax. We don't get the revenue from that. The first payment on that comes in January, and so this report is through December 31st, so it's just a timing issue. But trends are looking very positive, and all of the indications are that the revenues are performing at least or better than we anticipated that they would when we adopted the budget. Expenditures, by the same token, are also performing at least or better than they should be at this point of the fiscal year. There is one, the non-departmental that you see there is 60% expended, but that includes the entire year's payment for our liability insurance premium. So it kind of skews that number at the halfway point because that's 100% of the year's expense, but it happens early in the fiscal year. City attorney expenditures are also a little higher than 50%, in part because of the cost of the Centric Group investigation, which is a mid-year request that you have in front of you tonight to increase that appropriation. But in general, the trends are positive as far as the department expenditures are concerned. Departments are operating within their budgets. And that is consistent with the prior year as well. There are, however, a couple of adjustments that we need to make. The first one that you see listed there, $18,500, is for contract inspection services. This is kind of a good news, bad news item. The good news is we're busier than we thought we would be. The bad news is that means we need some more money to hire our contract inspectors. This is really driven from the building department, and primarily, again, kind of another good news item, it's solar installations that are kind of driving this one. We've seen solar permits go up from, we had 26 permits in calendar 2013, and we had 93 in calendar 2014, and 2015 is tracking the same or higher than 2014. So, as a result of that, we have an increased need for the contract inspectors that we have, and the flip side to that is we're achieving higher revenues, so there really is a revenue offset to this with no net impact to the general fund. The next one listed is the accounting manager reclassification, which I'll come back to. And the next three that make up the general fund requests are all items that were previously, their actions were previously directed by the council. However, the accompanying appropriation of funds didn't happen at the same time, which is not necessarily uncommon given the circumstances of these expenditures, the Cinder Group investigation, and the costs associated with the departure of our former city manager. That brings the general fund requests for increased expenditures to $178,000. We also have a request from the local sales tax fund for a server virtualization project at the police department. This would be a project that would allow us to have a redundancy in our IT network, which, as we all know, our IT network is critical to how we accomplish our business these days. So much of it relies on the computer and our network. This provides redundancy to our network and an off-site disaster recovery solution for the city. If something were to happen to City Hall, the police department would have an exact duplicate of the data on our network and would be able to be up and running seamlessly. This request is in front of you at this time simply because of the status of the police station project, where we are in the timing of that project. It makes a lot of sense to go ahead and do this virtualization work before this police department moves back into the building. It would reduce the downtime for the officers and the networking that needs to happen there. And we just want to take advantage of the fact that we're a little behind schedule on the... It's another good news, bad news. We're a little behind schedule in the police remodel, but the good news is we can take advantage of that to do this server virtualization work while there's minimal impact to staff. And then the request there for $31,000 for the lighted mid-block crosswalk repairs. As you may have even seen, a couple of the lights are out in the lighted crosswalks that are in the village here, and we need to get those repaired. We really do see this as a public safety issue that we need to move forward with. And that would come out of the streets fund, which is gas tax money, which luckily is performing a little better than we had projected based on the latest revenue estimates from the state. So going back to the accounting manager reclassification, I realize that the write-up in your staff report was pretty sparse. And so I wanted to provide you a little more information about that reclassification request. It's really based on an analysis of the job description and the current duties and responsibilities and complexities of the tasks assigned. There hasn't been a change in the supervisory aspect of that job. It continues to supervise three people. It's really about the complexity of the accounting-related work, not the supervisory work. This is the first in a series of job classifications that require review across the city, and I would anticipate that request will likely be forthcoming in the budget process to look at other positions in the city. It is something that we have to do from time to time, especially when we have major the way that we have structured our departments and dealt with some of the economic downturn by restructuring. Some of that just requires that then we come back and we check in with those job descriptions and see if they really are reflective of the duties that are being performed by the job. This particular reclassification is reflective of additional and complex accounting functions, as I mentioned, not so much the supervisory side. In particular, month-end, quarter-end, and year-end work that this position is required to perform that used to be performed by the director. There's additional responsibility for preparation of financial statements in conformance with generally accepted accounting principles, which have become more complex in recent years. And additional responsibility in budget preparation, particularly for the personnel cost projections, which is about 60% of our budget, so it's a significant portion of how we spend our funds. The timing for this request is at mid-year rather than with the biennial budget, reflects the fact that we expect this position to play a key role in preparing the 15-17 biennial budget. And while there is no current year fiscal impact in the spirit of full disclosure, there is a long-term fiscal impact to making this decision. Right now, we are offsetting the additional cost, or we would propose to offset the additional cost by the savings of reclassifying a senior accounting technician to an accounting technician. And again, that's based on the job duties that are performed by that desk. That reclassification downward in the accounting technician provides more than the $10,000 in additional cost that would ultimately be the cost of the reclassification for the supervisor to a manager position. Certainly in the current fiscal year, we will experience more savings than we will experience cost, and that would be true for the next three fiscal years as well. But in the long run, if you make this decision, then there will be a longer-term implication for the general fund. So I'm going to be, you know, clear with you on that. So in summary, the request for the reclassification is budget neutral or even positive in the next couple of years and is based on an analysis of the job duties, the experience, and the education required for that job. Moving on to revenue adjustments that we see at the mid-year. Again, these are... In the general fund, they come to about $362,000. This is I don't know if it means I'm not very good at forecasting how much revenue we're going to get or if things are just really turning around that well. Property taxes are up over $180,000 based on information from the county. We know what the triple flip amount will be, and that was a little bit higher in the current fiscal year. TOT seems to be doing really well. Part of that, I think, is really a reflection of the increased activity. Now, we've had a full year of the T-Bid out there promoting our destination, the hotels in our city, and TOT it just seems to be doing really well from that perspective. Sales tax is a little bit higher, and there are some other various revenues that are about $64,000. But in total, we expect that the general fund will bring in about $360,000 more in revenue than we anticipated when we prepared the budget. The local sales tax fund also will see, you know, sales tax is performing better both in the general fund and in the local sales tax fund. And like I said, the state has given us some estimates on gas tax revenues that in the current year are going to be a little bit higher, but I do have to forewarn you that next year they anticipate they will be about 30% lower. So it's kind of it's a one-time revenue that we'll see in the current year, so it seems to make sense to use that as for a one-time expenditure fixing the mid-block lighted crosswalks. The second half of the mid-year report is really all about providing you the status of the goals that the departments had identified in the biennial budget. We are making steady progress on achieving those goals. And in this six-month time period, there are a couple of really important and key, although I think Bob calls it dull but important, of work. The Affordable Care Act implementation, that was a tremendous amount of work for the HR manager. Happy to say that that is fully implemented now. The Public Works Department has recently implemented an automated work order and management system. That is going to pay off huge dividends for them in the very near term, and was a significant work effort on their part. And then we continue to make great progress on our sidewalk repairs and our pavement maintenance and our creek preservation and flood protection plans. So the recommendation in front of you tonight is to approve the detailed budget adjustments that are listed in the report. The summary of all of those wrap into Schedule A. And again, approve or deny the requests for the additional appropriations in the general fund, the sales tax fund, and the streets fund, and adopt a resolution creating the accounting manager job classification. So with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Okay, questions of staff? Councilmember Harmon?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Thank you. Can you tell me roughly how many staff hours were used to do this current report that we do every year? How much time, roughly? I know you don't know for certain, but can you just give me a rough estimate of the time and energy spent on this document?
Roughly 40 to 45 hours, probably.
Total.
Okay,
so then my other question is this document a standard document that other cities would use? And I'm particularly thinking of San Luis Obispo, because I know you came from that direction, and they had a really good reputation for their budgeting in it. It just seems to me that a lot of these adjustments could be made on a monthly basis versus having to do all this preparation and all this hard work for something that could be done as we go along.
There are pros and cons to individual what you might call one-off adjustments to the budget as opposed to a consolidated status update of where we are, having made all of those individual updates. It's not an uncommon thing to do mid-year budget reporting in cities across the country. It can be done in a number of ways. Certainly, if council is interested in pursuing some of those other alternatives, we could look at that and bring that back to you as something that, you know, some recommendations of what we might do. It's not uncommon to do this, but there's certainly lots of ways to do it.
Okay. And then I want to get to the accounting position issue. What has been the practice in terms of determining when someone needs reclassification? Is it, I mean, I work for the state of California, and everything's very formalized, and everything's, you know, there's a process in place. What's the process that has been used, generally speaking, in the city to determine changes in classification?
Having been here less than 2 years, I'm not sure that we have a defined process that some other larger organizations have. We certainly have looked at positions, like I said, when we restructured departments, we looked at what those jobs should be. That's been a number of years, so we don't necessarily have a formalized process. Like, for example, the city of San Luis Obispo has a very formal laid out process of how you go about doing this. We don't necessarily have that here, but it's not something that is undertaken lightly. It's not something that we do just on a whim. Sure. It's definitely something that is driven by
Absolutely.
An observation that the job duties have potentially changed enough that we need to take a look at it.
Okay, so then you also mentioned, and I think rightly so, that there's other positions in the city that need to be looked at. It seems that we shouldn't do this in a vacuum and just do one at a time. It seems like it should be part of an overall discussion, because ultimately it's going to have a larger impact on the budget as a whole. If we don't look at it as a whole and we do it piecemeal, we could get to the other end and go, wait a minute, the cost is prohibitive or have some unintended consequences. So I would suggest, and I know I apologize, Mr. Mayor, from going from questions to comments, but I have to say it, otherwise I'll forget it. I would suggest that we put off approving this classification and actually look at some other positions in total at the same time. Bob made a very interesting observation with me about Shane, and just as an example. And Bob, I can't remember the exact phrase that you used, but it had to do with the ability to, or the consequences of making an error. You had a phrase, and if you could help me with what that phrase was.
Excuse me. Mr. Mayor, members of council, one of the elements in evaluating any position is the consequence of error. It's just one of the standard HR practices in evaluating a position, what the replaceability of that individual, what the risk is to the organization, and the consequence of error is a term of HR art, if you want to say, as you go through evaluating a position and then determining where they rank in the organization, part of the salary establishment structure, the types of responsibilities and that you would expect out of that individual, the type of training also. Consequence of error is a term of art that you're referring
to. So the higher, I mean, in just roughly, the higher consequence of error, that person probably should be paid more so than a person who has less consequence of error of making an error, I should say.
It's one of many factors that goes into it, but yes.
Okay, very good.
Because for the obvious reason, they're held to a higher standard of accountability than for their actions and determinations, and usually require a higher level of preparation for the job that they're doing. That's why it tends to be that in utilities and other areas, salaries tend to be higher than that, because the consequence of error is potentially very significant, as you can imagine.
Very good. I could wander into comments, so I won't do that, Mr. Mayor, and those are the end of my questions.
Councilmember Guthrie.
Yeah, I'll get back to Tim's comments. In fact, I thought you'd be asking this question. I am going to ask, and I see the $50,000 for the virtualization, and that's clearly something new. Where are we going to be at with the whole police building project, is it going to come in at or near budget, or are we going to be here in 3 months talking about more money for the police building? I think that's probably directed at Jeff. Probably has the best answer there.
You know, as Jeff, please do come forward. As Jeff is wandering up, as a preamble to his statement, that's a process we're actually going through and looking at right now between all the parties within the department, Jeff being the lead on that, to evaluate exactly where we are with the project. We know that there are some outstanding concerns coming at us from a number of different angles, and it's timely for us to do the best estimating we can of where we potentially may be with those issues. This is going to be as much of a project management concern as it is also going to be a legal concern, going through a risk assessment process and potential liability process, and looking at where we stand with the project.
Mayor Hill, members of council, the police department project as of today is under budget. It is behind schedule, but we do anticipate that project will come in under the budget that was previously approved by council using some of the contingency funds. Challenging on this project was that we had a 10% contingency, which is very tight for a renovation project. You open up a wall and you don't know what's in there. You take the roof off and you don't know the damage that exists. So far we've been able to stay within that contingency. When we anticipate finishing the project within that contingency and not asking for additional funds. To answer your question?
Yeah, while you're up there, can I ask, related to the crosswalk lighting, I guess what struck me there is that it's a $31,000 appropriation, and if I read right, it's 5 to 7 years. Would we expect to be back here spending $31,000 in another 5 to 7 years?
That is a proprietary wireless technology that is top of the line in terms of crosswalk lighted technologies. Does have a 5 to 8 year lifetime on the lights. Of the 28 lights, each crosswalk has 14 lights, 7 on each side of the crosswalk. Only 2 of the lights have all of the bulbs inside the light working. And so some of those lights will hold on for a number more years, but they're starting to go out, and we believe that we need to replace them now. It is a 5 to 7 year investment. And so that's a kind of deferred maintenance issue. We should be putting money aside so that 7 years from now we can replace them again. There's some benefits to using that technology. It allows us to put the push button in any place. We don't have to trench across the street. Each one of those individual lights can be replaced easily, but it is not cheap.
So really we are just replacing light bulbs, $31,000 Okay.
They are.
I understand proprietary, and I'm just wondering: have we looked at alternatives? I mean, for instance, as I remember, not that I'm suggesting this, although I'm not sure I'm not, was the flashing light that we put over in on Fair Oaks. I remember that is $15,000 total.
Yeah, the flashing beacons that go on the side of the crosswalks are about $5,000 a piece in terms of those flashing units on each side. And there are less expensive technologies, however, this one allows us to replace them without cutting the street, without cutting the sidewalk. We have decorative sidewalks. There are some other costs inherent in a different type of less expensive light system, and so that decision was made a number of years ago. We believe at this point replacing them is the cheapest. We would have to tear up the street, put in trench across, put in additional wire across the street for a different technology. And so at this point, that would be the fastest most cost-effective way to deal with the lights that are going out now.
All right. Thank you. And then to get back to the job reclassification, are you talking about coming back with these other job descriptions and reclassifications at the mid-year budget in 2.5 months?
Councilmember Guthrie, it's our intent to bring those in as a part of the new budget process. And it's a relatively complex situation because I think Debbie expressed it well that there's been a lot of structural changes that have taken place, and we're now trying to initiate a process of going through and evaluating the impacts of some of those, and a lot of the changes have left us in a perhaps less than desirable position with all of the positions, and so we do to come back and. With council and share our thoughts about those. It is a pretty broad picture, though, so where this adjustment that's being proposed here is very situational within the finance department. It's actually been identified for a relatively long period of time, where the other ones are position adjustments that we're really kicking off looking at them right now. We have instincts about them, but we really want to come in with a very good evaluation of where they need to be adjusted to, and it seems like it would just make sense to be able to do that on a broad basis, looking at into the totality of the available budget to make any adjustments, to put them in some kind of a priority on the overall, so council can make an informed decision about those. So they will be coming back shortly, and we're actually going to do probably a whole budget session just on personnel, so we can really devote the time that is appropriate to.
And do you think we're talking about 5, 10? Get an idea of the range.
I think 10 is probably on the high end for it. And what I want to say, too, to not create concern, we see a lot of these as going to be long-term. We're not expecting the ability to be able to do all these all at one time. That's why we need to be able to look at them, prioritize them, and make the determinations where the greatest need is and the ability to fund those. The first determination actually, as Debbie has done, is can the department, in fact, make the adjustments internally so that it's a budget neutral change. That's what our objective on any of these would be. 10 is probably, at this point, would be the higher end of that. It would be likely something less than that. Most positions are exactly where they need to be. They're doing what they are where they need to be. We do have a few that are pretty askew, though.
All right. Thank you. Those are my questions.
Mayor Pro Tem Barnidge.
Thank you. Jeff, I just have a couple more questions for you on the crosswalk bulbs and then on solar. So you and I spoke about the same thing Jim was asking about. How long ago did those lights go in? Were they? Because I know you said they were out of the. There's a 5-year warranty, and we're outside of the warranty. I think that's what you. Is that what you said?
We are outside of the warranty now. And I believe I did not get the date. I believe it's been 7 years. It was when the East Branch Streetscape project took place. And so I don't know the date on that.
Yeah, maybe 5, 7 years. Okay.
So we know it was more than 5 years. I believe it's in the 7-year neighborhood.
Okay. And then just on the quick question on the solar permits, we had gotten an email probably almost a year ago from someone who owns a solar company in town, and he was talking about there was a bill that was making its way, and I think the bill was never signed into law, but trying to make solar permits easier to obtain. And our solar permits, how onerous are those? Do someone come in at the counter, fill out an application, someone goes out to the house and inspects it, and then that's it? Is that, I just sort of wanted to know what's involved in that.
You're asking me a question that's outside of my area of responsibility. I'd be happy to answer it, but probably not give you the right answer.
Okay. Oh, yeah, you're right. Community development. Okay. Yeah. Sorry, Jeff.
Lots of interest in solar permits and indeed some changes in legislations that will make it easier. Right now they're pretty, it's electrical permit. You come in and then you get a solar permit. The issue has just been inspections, and it's just been on a variety of new contractors out there, new technologies, a new field. So contractors are getting used to what the requirements are to install, and it's just been that it's been requiring repeat inspections. Mm-hmm. to make sure that that we can sign off on the actual installation. So I think it's going to get better. I think it's just been, you know, a couple years of learning for both contractors and inspectors alike to kind of get a strategy in place and to make the permitting process easier.
Okay, so does staff have to usually visit the home more than once?
That has been the case, indeed.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. Okay, thank you. Those are my only questions.
Excuse me. If you wouldn't mind, I'll add what the state concern is, and actually the issue of what the state is doing to try to make the permitting process is one that is also that is at time and at odds with local control, and it has to do with engineering standards. As in many cases, solar panels that go on top of roofs have a virtual non-impact on the structural integrity of the home. But there are times when they, in fact, could have a considerable structural integrity impact, and sometimes we're not necessarily being installed on a roof, but on a carport or some other type of a structure. And what the state has been trying to do to encourage the use of solar is to just put the obligation of the structural integrity totally on the installer outside of the process of local review and what a building department would want to do to ensure that, in fact, there is sufficient structural integrity. So this has actually been somewhat of an ongoing issue between the local building departments and structural engineers, if you want to say, and the state, where they're trying to make it easier to put them out there. But our local building officials have been concerned about the long-term implications of negating the local agency's ability to ensure the structural integrity of what they're being put on. So it's been an ongoing issue for the last several years.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
I guess at the risk of commenting during the question period, the repeat inspections and the technical expertise related to the solar inspections, is that something that the budget adjustment, if I understand it, is to get contract inspectors? Would it be perhaps advantageous for the city to engage an employee? Cost recovery on that with the inspections and the kinds of things that you mentioned is the structural integrity of what you're putting the solar installation on would enter into it. So I guess have we thought about that? Is to form, Alex, I'll take a solar inspection for $100, please. To formulate it as a question, have we thought about an additional staff position, perhaps as opposed to contract? And then also, I note just. Have we thought about, and I guess you touched on it in terms of the actual, this is the budget adjustment point rather than the new budget point, but at the new budget point or somewhere, I hope we're looking at, public works in terms of manager positions there, information technology, which is absolutely critical to the functioning of the city in terms of our public safety, the police department, emergency response, all of those things, and possibly staffing in the police department. I know there's been mergers and cutbacks and so forth, and the Affordable Care Act was mentioned. And I'm sorry to ramble about all of this stuff, but again, to kind of formulate it as a question, where there's been a lot of part-time positions and so forth, is it appropriate to look at that now in terms of the mid-year adjustment, or is that more of a, do we plan to do that more in the full-on budget process?
Let me get to the bottom line short answer. I believe it is most appropriate to look at a part as the overall budget process. That would be my recommendation, because it really is, there could be potentially some relatively robust recommendations that are going to be made in here, and we need to make those recommendations in light of the totality of the budget that will be prepared and considered by council. Going into the little bit of the details, you've really now touched on the heart of what we really need time to be able to do, and even within this budget starting right now, we won't be able to complete that. The question of looking at using a full-time employee versus a contractor, that is specifically one of them that's on the board to look at. And we have to look at it from the standpoint of the likelihood of the permitting level remaining at some sustained level to, in fact, warrant a full-time position versus that it's a spike or an anomaly of some sort that would just leave us ultimately with extra positions. The value of the contract is being able to spike up and down. But on the other hand, as we were by way of comparison, as we were having some discussions on staffing for meter reading right now, where we have a contract that can read at a dollar a meter, our comparative in-house cost for that is 60 cents a meter. It's significantly less for a whole variety of reasons. And typically, this work can be done less on an in-house basis and providing some other controls. So what the position audits and actually to add to the Administrative Services Director's response on the process for evaluating the positions, it's usually a two-step process and one that is labor-intensive to do, but from an HR perspective, it is a best practices that every position be given at least a cursory view on some kind of a regular frequency, whether it's 3 years or 5 years or some kind of frequency. There's no golden rule on that, but it's important that it be done consistently. So one is just a re-endorsement that this is the right description. The second, though, that should be a part of every budget process, and we'll do it here, is for the department heads, the executives who are managing this, to make a recommendation that says, I feel that this position is no longer suitable for how the duties have migrated in here, and I would like to request that we do a position audit or a position classification study. So between, and then that would be put into a priority or given weight to other work that's going on, then make a decision if you'll do that or not. Between those two factors, if you embrace those and have those a part of your routine, you can be assured that on a pretty regular basis, you are looking at all the positions one way or the other, and you're remaining consistent with the job duties and all. So that's we're going to be initiating that process, but that on it is not to be complete and won't be complete in a year. We'll look at referred to as the most egregious issues. Maybe that's an overstatement, but the ones that appear to have the most significance right now, and then we'll roll out a program that we can do this on an ongoing basis. It's important, from my perspective, to do it regularly so that you're not periodically hit with this giant change that's taking place. It simply is a budgetary challenge to be able to do, but to do them incrementally so employees feel they're being treated fairly, used fairly, and all of those other factors.
Then I guess my last comment and question would be, having looked at the police department remodel and the fence out in the employee parking part of the yard there, looks to me to be somewhat inadequate in terms of making an adjustment that we talked about projections and looking at where we're coming in, where we would expect that to come in, whether it's over budget or under budget. It looks to me like that might be an area that should be looked at again and may end up with additional cost that is to be incurred going forward.
Mr. Mayor, that's exactly correct, and it's why Mr. English exactly stated correctly that the contract project is going to come in likely within the budget amount or under what has been set aside. The issue at hand, though, is that there are some issues that are unaddressed in that contract. such as some barriers, visual barriers on the roof, and some other screening that needs to take place in the parking lot. But one of the more significant ones is what you have exactly brought up, is the really inadequate fencing, the what I would call right now from a security perspective. In a police agency, you simply don't allow public viewing into areas that allow exposure to public safety individuals, and that's what this, unfortunately, that's what this has resulted in. And not by carelessness. There was an original design issue that was extremely cost prohibited to be able to do, and this was the best under the circumstance backup that could take place. But now we have to seriously address it. This would be known as an officer safety issue that we need to take very seriously and address. So we don't really know what that's going to be, and trying to do this in a way that is cost effective and yet appealing to the community, because it obviously is a big visual screen around there, and there's lots of landscaping, fortunately, that's going outside. But even that has to be done carefully, because you can't create areas to hide in that, areas of concealment, as they refer to it. So so we need to be coming back with that to make sure that our next step in this is being done in the proper way.
Okay. I guess that's the end of questions. Is there any public comment on this item? Recalling that is the mid-year budget adjustment. Okay, hearing none. Discussion. Councilmember Guthrie.
So I guess I'll start with... Council may remember one time we actually did this quarterly. We reduced it to semi-annually for some of the reasons expressed here. I personally like having a snapshot. I can see where you could accomplish this monthly, but then you lose track of where you're really at. It isn't, to me, it's important. I'm surprised it takes 45 hours, but if that's what it takes to give us a real snapshot of where we are, which really twice a year, then I think that's really really time well spent. I guess my first thought on the reclassification, I was very concerned that we just had what I'll call position creep. Happens in the private sector, certainly happens then, where you have really great employees and they've outgrown their position. You don't really have the position, so therefore let's create a position. And in the private sector, when it happens, when that employee goes away, either gets promoted or goes somewhere else, typically the position disappears. But my concern is that doesn't always take place in the public sector. I did review this thoroughly with, and I do think this is a justified change. It's not a, it really is a responsibility creep that over the last probably 10 years, as we discussed, the responsibilities of an accounting department have increased by different demands, much of it driven by Bell, but by what took place in the city of Bell. So I'm okay with this reclassification. I do sort of share the, I like to see them all together. I'm not quite sure. I guess we have some timing issues here, and I can go either way with approving this now or making it part of the budget process and reviewing all of them at once. Other than that, I don't have any problems with the adjustments that are reflected here. I do think it is a reflection of considering how few adjustments we have here. I actually think that we did pretty well in our original estimates, both on the cost side and on the income side. $162,000 sounds like a lot of money, but I think it's $6.5 million worth of property tax, so it's really not that huge a number in percentages. So, at any rate, yeah, I'm certainly okay with approving the as proposed this evening. Thank you.
Mayor Pro Tem Barnage.
Thank you. I don't have any concerns with what staff is proposing, and I'm happy to move forward tonight. Thank you.
Councilman Harmon.
Yes, I'll echo the sentiments of my other council members. I would like to reiterate, I do like the mid-year budget. I think because of the way some of the ebb and flow of the funding, whether they're the expenditures or the revenues coming in and when we get them, I think if we do it, you know, even on a quarterly, maybe we wouldn't have a specific picture on that, because we'd always have to be saying, but don't forget we've got property taxes coming in, or if it's the DMV or the gas tax or something like that. So I would support the mid-year process continuing. Initially, I had some concerns about the reclassification, not so much pertaining to the justification, but because it's occurring mid-year, where, you know, normally those things would be done upon budget review or yearly budget review. But given the justification for it, you know, I think of the Affordable Care Act, although that's more of an HR umbrella under their umbrella. But when you look at all of the intricacies that our finance department has had to take on, even in the last year, there really is a demand on the workload, and it's a critical workload that they do for our city. So when I kind of weighed it on that, then I was able to reconcile that the need would be appropriate to move forward on it now, and I also support the adjustments that are proposed. If you kind of do the math on two of the biggest items, that was really related to something that was very unforeseen, and attributed to a huge budget adjustment for us, and you know, that's the way that we have to proceed. So I'm ready to move forward.
Councilmember Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. First of all, I would prefer that the reclassification be done along with the other ones, because I think it gives us a better idea, rather than doing a piecemeal, what we're actually looking at for costs. So I would prefer that. And the other thing that crosses my mind, we haven't talked about the reduction for you called it the desk, but it sounds to me like there's a live human being that's actually going to take a pay reduction as well.
That's not the case. When Tricia moved over to the fire department, the accounts payable desk was vacant. And when we recruited for that position, we recruited for it at the lower position.
Okay.
So
thank you for that.
No one will be taking a pay cut.
Thank you for that. The other thing is, we keep talking about, and Jim mentioned quarterly, then we went to mid-year. I've had some discussions with Bob, and and I think you came from San Luis Obispo, Debbie, and they have a different budget process. I think before we make a decision about what the best avenue is, I think we should explore what those avenues could be or should be. Because we've been doing it a certain way for a certain amount of time, and we've grown comfortable with it, I don't think it hurts to get an outside view or an outside perspective. And when I say that, I mean you, Bob. what other options might be out there that are effective. And you also mentioned, I think, there was one of the items that was missing in the budget review. And correct me if I'm wrong, but it was basically like a budget target. Did we reach our target? You were talking about a column that was missing in the budget review, and so there's just little things that I think we should look at and consider whether there's a better way to do things. So, and you talked about, I think, actually coming forward at some point and talking about the budget. So that would probably be the appropriate time to do that. So, anyway, so those are my comments. I'm ready to go forward with everything but the reclassification. I would request that be put off until that future date.
I guess I'm ready to support this again with some comments. The points were brought up by, you know, potential monthly review, quarterly review, that sort of thing. I don't think a monthly review is necessarily warranted, because a lot of things come in as either quarterly payments or semi-annual payments, and you can get a false sense of what's going on by looking too often at the status. But still, a quarterly or a mid-year, either one should be appropriate to identify things that are not going in the direction that you intend. If something's going south, either you're getting hopefully a lot more revenue than you expected, but more likely costs are going out of control at some point, that those factors would be looked at and some corrective action could be taken to try to steer the thing back onto the middle of the road. And that's what I look at in terms of a mid-year, is an opportunity to make those corrections and relook at whatever the item might be. We brought up the flashing lights in the street, and it would seem to me prudent to perhaps, if we know that this has a 5 to 7 year life, maybe on a 5 year cycle, is to include in the budget the prorated amount of money to make the replacements that we know are coming up. So, but on an annual budget basis, that the same sort of thing would govern. If you see something going south and you can identify what the problem is, that the fact that it is going south, and hopefully be able to take some corrective action to bring it back. So that's why I value a mid-year. And I share Councilmember Brown's concern about formatting and of the budget and what's included there. So hopefully in the budget process coming up, we can take some of those recommendations and perhaps include them in what is our process. So with that, I'm ready to support the since the accounting manager job classification is revenue neutral, in some of the others we may have to look at making adjustments one way or the other. Hopefully we've got additional revenue that might allow some of those classification reviews to be essentially neutral, but I'm prepared to support this at this time. So with that,
I'll move to approve the detailed budget adjustments listed in the mid-year budget report. Also to approve Schedule A. Approve the request for the additional appropriations in the general fund, sales tax fund, and street fund, as well as adopt a resolution creating the account manager job classification. And does that resolution need to be read at this point? Okay.
Second.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded that we adopt the staff recommendation. May I have a roll call, please?
Councilmember Herman?
Yes.
Mayor Pro Tem Barnidge?
Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Mayor Hill?
Yes. Moving to item 11C.
Item 11C is consideration of the status of the city's California Public Employees Retirement System plans.
Director Malicote, you have the report.
Mr. Mayor, members of council, I would like to make a couple of preamble comments prior to that, and then Director Malicote will make her report. First, I just want to note that I think the previous discussion that we had was extremely healthy, and this evening, and in particular this report, is what we want to kick off this budget season with, providing substantive information, alternatives, have discussions, a whole variety of issues with the City Council about your very important budget process. The timing of this being appropriate as you're now entering into your new two-year budget plan that you'll be considering over the next few months and hopefully adopting in the latter part of June. In going through this these next few months, we want to bring forward a number of discussion points to you. And in saying that, I want to be sure to clarify that it is not out of criticism for anything that's taken place in the past. Your completed audit report by the independent outside auditors have recently and once again given you a very clean bill of health. Procedures, processes are right. Every penny is accounted for as it should be, and no material findings anyway. That doesn't mean as we're going forward and as our budgetary issues and needs and community issues become more complicated that we shouldn't take advantage of times to look at, is there ways to even do better to meet current needs and demands? Are we embracing all of the current best practices efforts? And that's where we really want to take an opportunity to have those kinds of discussions with the council. They, in some cases, they may end up making changes, and other issues after discussion, they may not. But it's good to be able to have that discussion. This evening is rolling out an issue that is simply a critical expense factor for not only Rio Grande, but for every agency, and that is our retirement system, the PERS system. And Director Malakot has provided for Council this evening what is going to be probably the first of at least two presentations that are going to take place. And this one is very much a status of where we're at. It's the numbers. It's how the PERS system works, often referred to as some sort of black art or science or something to it. It's an actuarial forecast, which means that there is simply a lot of factors that are taken and given a best estimate at the implications of, a variety of factors, but that's exactly what the retirement system is. Within this report, in addition to the information that Ms. Malakot is going to provide, we're making a recommendation to bring on a consultant, John Bartel, and his firm, literally to provide us more detailed and a much more exhaustive and extensive evaluation of Rio Grande's per system retirement system. This individual will come in and literally second guess the budgetary assumptions of PERS so that in the end, hopefully between those two, we have a really good picture of what we can anticipate in the future. Is the numbers are just so large, they every year will continue to have a significant impact on our ability to move forward and make other adjustments while holding actually a defined benefit really just in place. We're not really getting additional benefit out of it. There are simply just costs that go along with it. They are the cost of business. With Mr. Bartels, we'll be able to give his council alternatives and guidance in the future and your decision making as far as in far as employees and strategies to be able to deal with what Director Malakot will be giving on the unfunded the PERS unfunded balance liability balance unfunded liability balance that you and literally every agency exists. There is absolutely nothing out of line with the report that you're going to receive from a standpoint of comparison to other agencies. Literally all are in a very similar boat, and all are scrambling to find the best ways, best options to be able to move forward in addressing this very significant issue. So that is a relatively lengthy introduction into what was going to be the first of many presentations similar to this, hopefully with a shorter introduction by me to get right down to the meat of the issue. And with that, I will turn it over to Ms. Malakot.
Thank you. As you may know, PERS is a very complex topic, and you can spend hours on any one particular aspect of PERS, which I don't intend to do. So in a very, very brief background, CalPERS has retirement formulas that are available. In this city, we have three tiers of employees. We have our first-tier employees that have been here for generally the longest period of time. We did implement second-tier benefits a couple of years ago, and then in the public pension reform arena, there came out some legislation affectionately called PEPRA, that significantly changed the pension formulas for new hires. And so we do have three tiers here in the city, and PERS categorizes employees into one of three classifications. You're either safety police, safety fire, or miscellaneous. There's two ways that PERS is funded. One portion is the employee share. How much that is depends upon your formula, depends upon your classification, but it's generally 7, 8, 9% of your payroll. That's paid for by employees, and in this city, all of our employees pay their employee share. That has not historically always been the case, but in recent negotiations, that's one of the cost measures that we were able to put into place with negotiations, that all employees are paying their own employee share of PERS. And the employer share is that what's required in order to pay the benefits, the difference between what we need and what the employees pay falls on the employer. And so the employer share is that's the piece of it we often call our PERS rate or our PERS cost. It's usually, in the past, it was expressed as a percentage of payroll. So for every dollar that you pay an employee, you may pay 23 cents, for example, to PERS for their pension benefit. Benefit formulas are often expressed. You'll hear people say 2.5 at 55. What the heck does that mean? It means that, for example, an employee that reaches retirement age or retires at 55 with, let's say, 30 years of service and a salary of $75,000, the way that you calculate simplistically their pension benefit is that their 30 years of service gives them 2.5% of their pay for each year of service. So 30 years of service times 2.5%, they would get a 75% benefit. Multiply that by their salary, in this example of $75,000, means that there would be an annual retirement benefit of a little over $56,000. The unfunded liability is really the calculation between how much money do you need to set aside today in order to meet your pension obligations to all the employees that you have an obligation versus how much money is there actually set aside. And the difference is the unfunded liability. It is a snapshot in time. PERS does this at June 30th. And the other thing to keep in mind with PERS data is by the time you get the information, it's 2 years old. So there's a lag time between when they do the calculation and when those rates go into effect. In the city, our unfunded liability at June 30th, 2013, that is the most recent actuarial valuation that we have, is approximately $17 million. And that does include what I've included there is sort of our share, the city's share of the Five Cities Fire Authority pension obligations. Even without that's a $419,000 liability. We're still, $16.8 million. That is the difference between what we should have in the bank to pay employees versus what we do have in the bank to pay employees. It sounds like a really scary number. But for a lot of reasons, it's not the only number we need to pay attention to. This is what our unfunded liability has done since 2003. A lot of people remember in the early 2000s, many PERS plans were what they called superfunded. We actually had more money in the bank than we needed to pay benefits. And at that time, quite a few agencies paid nothing into PERS. Their employer rates were zero. That, by the way, has changed with PEPRA, where there were no longer those, what they call employer holidays, are no longer allowed under PEPRA. There will always be some sort of a contribution to PERS. But you can see that both our police and our miscellaneous, this is representative of our first tier our first-tier employee plan, because that's the one with most of our employees in it, you can see that we were moving right along. We were pretty close to 100% funded, and then, of course, the stock market crashed. The economy went downhill, and you can see that we dropped to right around 60% funded in our plans. And then since then, we've sort of steadily been climbing back up, mostly based upon the investment experience that PERS is achieving. This is a little bit of a view of what our neighboring friends and cities are experiencing as well. This is for the 6/30/13 evaluation period, where we are approximately 70% funded. So are most of all of our friends and neighbors. We all sort of went through the same experience. We were all sort of super funded way back in the early 2000s. The market crashed, and we're all sort of recovering at roughly the same rate. If we saw significant changes in this, and by significant I don't mean 1 or 2 percentage points, if there were lots of cities that were down in the 40 and 50% and others that were way up in the hundreds, but we were at the 70s, that might cause me more concern. But the fact that we're all sort of in this same boat, whether I don't know if that's comforting, but we're all at least in it together. But it does reinforce the point that this is largely market-driven by what's happening at PERS and the performance of their portfolio. Nevertheless, it is impacting us, how their portfolio has performed. They've also made a number of changes at PERS to try to reduce the impact to employers and to try to not have large swings in employer rates and contribution levels. Some of these are as a result of PEPRA. Some of them were sort of unintended consequences of PEPRA. One of the things that they realized with PEPRA is that you will never have any more employees coming into your first-tier plans. You have hired every first-tier employee you will ever have. To an actuary, that means you have a closed pool. I don't know exactly what that means to an actuary, but it's pretty significant when you have no more people coming into the pool. So the analysis that needs to go into that has caused PERS to realize that they really need to combine all of their plans into two pools, a public safety pool and a miscellaneous pool. There are a number of methodologies that they have put into place related to smoothing actuarial assumptions that they review from time to time. They have, in the upcoming year, they have changed the way that they're going to collect our PERS payment, and it will no longer be a percentage of payroll. It will be a flat dollar amount that amortizes our unfunded liability plus a percentage of payroll that represents the normal cost of pension costs. So that's a new change coming up for fiscal year 2015-16. And the way that they've allocated payments on those unfunded liabilities, it's very complicated, and I don't even pretend to understand the tip of the iceberg of the PERS world. But needless to say, it does change a lot of the way that those PERS costs get passed down to us. They have recently decided to move to a 30-year amortization period for gains and losses, investment gains and losses. It's really a 25-year amortization period, but there's a 5-year ramp-up to get there. Similarly, when they make changes to their methodology or to their actuarial assumptions, like demographics and that type of thing, those changes would be amortized over a 15-year period with a 5-year ramp-up, so a 20-year period. The assumptions that they have made currently looks like people are living longer in retirement, which is good news for those of us who hope to retire someday. Not so good news for those of us paying for those pension benefits, because people are living longer in retirement. And in some plans, although not necessarily the plans that we have in our city, they are actually seeing earlier retirements. That wasn't the case for a number of years, particularly when the economy went south. A lot of employees who had intended to retire postponed their retirement, you know, based on a number of factors, but they are now starting to see that trend turn, and employees are retiring earlier. And the overall bottom line of all of this is that our rates are going to increase, and we just don't quite know how much. They've given us an estimate for 15-16. It is astonishing. It's pretty high. It's a roughly a 25% increase in cost, so dollar over dollar compared, which is a significant challenge to us. There are some things about that I really think that John Bartel will be able to help us dig into. And I'm not saying that the PERS numbers are wrong and they are what they are, but I think we may be able to have some conversations with our actuary to understand those numbers better, because they are in conflict with some other information that we got from PERS that indicated that our rates really wouldn't change that much. They'd go up a little bit, but not huge. So one more reason why I really feel strongly we need to get John Bartel in here to help us understand those rates and help us understand the information that we previously got from PERS that indicated they would be higher but not significantly higher, and the reality of the rates that we did receive from them. So this is a chart that PERS put out, and when they were deciding some of the ways that they were going to smooth the impact of these decisions, ultimately they chose alternative two, which are the little blue graphs. And I know this is kind of hard to read, but it essentially shows that just about everybody was going to have a very minor impact to their rates. I mean, we're talking 2 to 3% of payroll. Sort of at the outside, there was maybe one little guy out there with an 8 or 9 or 10% of payroll impact. And they at that time told us that we would see virtually no change. It is 0.3, I think, was the impact that they calculated for us. So we would have been on the far left side there, where we're kind of not seeing much of a change, or right in there with the middle of the pack. That's not the reality of the PERS rates that we received. So this is the sort of conflict of information that we are getting from PERS. On one hand, they indicated that we would be seeing very little impact, some but very little, but the PERS rates we received are significantly higher than that. So it is complex. There are a lot of variables, and I certainly don't even pretend to understand what actuaries, how they do the voodoo that they do. So it would, I think, behoove us to bring in someone like a John Bartel and his team, who really are the premier PERS actuaries in the state, because we know that those rates are going to be significant, and we know that they're going to cause challenges to us in our future budgeting. And we need to be able to make the best decisions, and that requires us to have the best information available, in my opinion. So I think before we can even talk about strategies for how to mitigate it or what we might be able to do with this information, we really need to make sure that it's good, solid information and that we understand what it's telling us. So that's a very, very, very brief overview of where we are with our PERS plans and the impacts of the changes that PERS is making. And the recommendation in front of you is essentially to direct us to engage John Bartel Associates to provide actuarial analysis to help us in our future planning.
Okay. Mr. McFaul, you have a
only. I promise one very brief comment, just as an endorsement. If the question is to be asked, my assessment is that the City of Arroyo Grande in the last few years has made all of the right determinations and adjustments to try to address this problem during the recession by renegotiating PERS contracts to go to a second tier. That was absolutely the right thing to do. That was successful. Had that not been done, your rates that you'll be looking at are even greater. Not large, not a lot, because there's not a lot of impact yet from that, but it certainly would make a difference. Now going mandatorily going to the third tier that you're in, that's great. So you have already taken previous actions to begin to get a handle on this. Not all agencies did that. Not all agencies were successful in their negotiations to be able to do that. But congratulations to your agency for doing it. So it puts you in the best possible position that you could be at this point in time.
Okay, questions for staff. Council Member Harmon.
I guess for
the folks that I have a heightened radar when the word consultant comes up, just in general. And I know that it has been explained to me on various levels related to the use of consultants. And so I just wanted to kind of lead to a question. The complexities of what you've just described, if under any other circumstance it appears that the use of a consultant specifically for this would be one of those areas where this would be totally justified. So I guess for the folks that might be maybe still awake and watching at home, can you just kind of go over again the just very briefly on, you know, kind of the justifications for this use of the consultant? I know that the amount of the contract is, you know, not very large. And then also the qualifications. I've heard that Mr. Bartel sets the standard, but perhaps it would be a benefit to our community to hear that.
Debbie and I can joint on respond on this. In the world of when do you make a decision to make a to hire a consultant, and there's a variety of times when you do that. One of them is when the skill set that you need is simply not resident when you within your organization, and in fact, it wouldn't make any financial sense to try to have that that skill set because it's used on such an infrequent basis. Without making this any reflection on any city's finance staff, or Royal Grande or others, nobody retains actuarials on a ongoing basis to be a part of their staff because there simply isn't a need for it. And so that is a skill that you would bring in, and that's as we're recommending in this case. An actuarial is somebody that that combines a variety of skills that includes economic forecasting and an understanding of long-term economics and economic trends and finance trends and investment trends. An actuarial at times can be a really good person to talk to about investing your portfolio because they simply have to understand the implications of those. So as they look at PERS, one of the things that John will do is he'll look at PERS and he'll look at their investment portfolio. He actually levied a criticism a number of years ago when PERS decided to start investing in housing, which was very unusual. The housing market collapsed and the PERS returns on their investment collapsed. He had predicted that before it ever took place, and it's a policy now that PERS has changed because part of what we want to be, what any agency wants, is for PERS to be wildly successful in their investment portfolio, because it is not just a matter of a simple extrapolation of we have a certain number of employees that are guaranteed this amount and they're going to have this lifetime, and so how much we put in. It's how much of the ongoing financial need is going to be gained through the gains, will be reached through the gains of the investment portfolio. And so while, is it 7% or 7.5% right now? Okay, so currently PERS has targeted that we will make 7.5% a year on our very diverse investment portfolio. Used to be 7%. At one point in time, it was 8%. 7.5%, you know, pretty much all of us would like to be making 7.5% on it. So if PERS makes 10%, which sometimes they make more than what they estimate, that's good for us. That means that could actually have a positive influence on our rate and the 2 years later, as Debbie had indicated. If they make 5%, then the money still has to be put into the pool. We will have to pay more to make that adjustment up. That's why it's an up and down all the time. Some agencies, I won't say many, but some agencies actually, in using Mr. Bartel, and they use them on an annual basis or perhaps every 2 years, they will, of course, pay what PERS says that they need to do, but they will also set money aside on an ongoing basis to be able to assist when there are spikes. such as what we're experiencing right now. So if they're at a time where the rates have dropped down to 10%, they don't necessarily take that 10% and then spend it in other recurring expense areas. They actually maintain putting that money aside in a separate retirement fund, so when the rates start going up again, they don't have to make draconian adjustments to their budget and impact the services. They start drawing money out of those funds to be able to levelize the rates. And those are the kind of strategies that John can talk to you about. So if you were one of those very few cities that had the willpower and the discipline to say times are good, but they won't always be good, so we're putting that money away and we're investing that money through our treasurer, and then when the rates start going up, we can pretty much keep our services normal, do all the other things, and we start drawing down on that. And that's a cycle that they'll go through. But that's the complexity of it. So the skills of the actuarial hit all of those kinds of financial areas, including literally being really, really good with a crystal ball.
Very good. Thank you for that. And then just two more. Is there a targeted percentage that's a goal or a standard related to unfunded liability? You know, we're at 70%. Is there a standard or a goal that if you can maintain, I don't know, an 85% level or a 90% level, then that's an assurity that the city would have? Or it seems like, and maybe it's because of the complexity of PERS, it's no longer a factor, but it seemed like there was a number out there where cities would or agencies would strive for with their unfunded liabilities, where they would want to make sure they didn't go below a certain line.
There are all kinds of strategies to that, and those are actually very important strategies in that whole topic that you just brought up. I mean, the ideal goal is they try to be at or near 100%, but on a regular, predictable, sustainable basis, because that means that you're funded. That means that PERS is investing your money at a rate more than you can do. You know, our treasurer, who is sitting right here, cannot. Is prohibited through a whole variety of legal reasons of being able to get that kind of return. So if we can turn it over to an agency like PERS who can get 7.5%, that definitely is better than what our or any agency's treasurer is going to be able to do. So the higher that you can have, the larger amount that you can have invested with PERS, from my perspective, you're simply money well ahead, if for nothing else, but through the investment option, the investment capacity that they have that we don't, that we're not able to have. 30%, where a lot of people are at right now, that translates into a pretty large annual hit of your budget. The percentage of your salary is just huge at that amount. It is not a place that you want to be. It is, even though the problem, though, is even though all the best efforts that Arroyo Grande has done, and you have done nothing wrong in your investment and you're paying your PERS, you've done exactly what they have told you to do. There is nothing that has been done wrong in this case. This is a market issue. It's actually probably two things. It's one of PERS. And I'm not broadcasting to Sacramento right now and being criticizing with them. I would hate to be the individual who is responsible for managing this monster. But for one, PERS tends to understate their issues, and they tend to understate the future contributions that an agency will need to have. And there's a variety of factors that would be much too long to go into this discussion tonight with, but they just traditionally seem to have that as an experience. So if you take first that you know, we've likely have been not necessarily given the best long-term numbers, and then blend that with just the downturn in the economy on it, that's why everybody is where we're at right now. Okay. There's really nothing much you could do about it.
One last question. What would be the turnaround or the timeline for Mr. Bartel in the completing the actuarial?
I don't have an exact date for him. He and I had conversation about the council's need for this information as soon as possible, so that we can really have this information
to help guide those budget decisions and determine what sorts of maybe short-term and long-term opportunities are available for us. So I don't have a firm date, but it will be as expeditious as we possibly can make it.
Okay, thank you very much.
Councilmember Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I think you answered most of my questions. It almost feels like a lot of the unfunded liabilities is structural. And if it's structural, I don't really know how we meaningfully attack that 30%. I just don't see how we do it. I don't know how financially how we do it, actuary or not. We can come up with every plan in the world, but that's a huge sum over time to make up. So that's just a comment. But my question was, you talked about a flat amount to start making up the unfunded liability along with a percentage of payroll. Is that borne completely by us, or is that shared by the employees as well?
That is the new strategy for the employer contribution. So the employee contribution is set at a flat rate, whatever that is, 6, 7, 8%, depending upon what plan you're in. But the employer contribution is the one that is being changed instead of a percentage of payroll to being that dollar amount that amortizes your unfunded liability plus the percentage that's the normal cost.
And the theory behind that flat rate is that sometime we'll reach a point where we don't have any unfunded liability?
If that day
in
ever
theory,
comes.
In theory, it's all theory.
Yes. Yeah, let me relate it in this way. You can look at the way they're approaching this. The unfunded liability is like the mortgage on your house. You know, it's a dollar amount that's out there, and we're assigning an interest rate to it and a monthly payment that's being made. In this case, an annual payment. The difference, though, is that every 2 years they will do an actuarial analysis to see if that remaining balance on your mortgage has changed, because the investment didn't come in, the federal government, the Department of Community Development and Housing came out and say, well, men are now living to 92 years old, you know, a whole variety of factors. So even though we might go along for a number of years or a couple of years paying one amount that is a fixed amount, that does not mean that next year or 2 years or 3 years from now that amount likely will not go down, but very likely will actually go up. So thus the importance of the long-range planning in here, and to have, you know, in my mind, the relatively modest cost services of a John Bartel on a regular basis, just to give us the very best possible advice that we can. One of the strategies that cities use is to, like you do on a mortgage, is try to pay down that that balance. So when they have, there's some that when they're finished with the capital improvement program, that amount goes to PERS, pay it in. If they get a windfall of some sort, put it into PERS to pay that amount down. Tremendous self-discipline to be able to do that, organizational discipline to do it, and at the expense of, you know, a whole list of other unmet needs in the agency. But these are policy decisions that we need to make sure the council knows all these different options. But there's no singular best path to do it.
Councilmember Guthrie?
I don't have any questions at this point. They've all been answered. Thanks.
Mayor Pro Tem Barnidge.
Just the one question. Mr. Bartel, so 2 months, a month, 6 months? Because I know you said as soon as possible, but I'm just trying to gauge how long that is. I mean,
my hope is less than 60 days.
Yeah. Okay.
I think a couple of months.
Okay. All right. Thank you for that. That's the only questions
and
I have.
If you want to see the output, I believe that I emailed to council a report that he recently did for another agency. That would be the kind of information that we would get. And you see it's very charts and graphs oriented. That's the work that he does. And that is information, but it's going to be particularly helpful when he's standing at the podium talking to you through all of that, where you can really just ask all these questions to somebody who can really help us with that.
Okay, is there a public comment on this item? Hearing none, any discussion? Councilmember Harmon?
Well, call me crazy, but I am very pleased that we're actually having this discussion about unfunded liabilities. There is an unfortunate tendency. This is such a critical part of the budget process. There's an unfortunate tendency to overlook it, to, dare I say, hide it in the budget process. So I'm very proud of our city that we're having this discussion, that we're discussing the very real concerns and our responsibilities regarding our unfunded liabilities. So with that being said, and also I think the complexities that have already been discussed here, the risks, all of the unknown variables, and the fact that the contract is minimal for what we will gain, let's just green light go and get it done.
Councilmember Brown.
I agree.
Councilmember Guthrie.
Yeah, I don't have too much to add there. Certainly we'll have more comments when we have more specifics on going forward, but I think, as you noted, it sort of is what it is in the short run. It is some of these longer run budgeting decisions. I mean, we have actually paid down not just PERS, but a number of other liabilities out there, partly because, as noted, they get a lot more income than we do with the payback was much higher. So, yeah, I'm certainly fair with moving forward what we have here this evening.
Mayor Pro Tem.
Thank you. I'm in favor of moving forward as well. I thought this is obviously one of the times where we really need a consultant, and so I look forward to his report, having him pick apart all the numbers. I think it's really important. It's timely because of the budget. I actually thought his $7,000 charge was a typo because I thought, wow, that's cheap. And the PowerPoint, the staff report, I read through a couple times. It's kind of a convoluted, and my husband's a PERS employee. And then actually after I read through it twice, he explained it to me on paper, which we don't even want to go there because he was frustrated with me. I felt like I was back in algebra in eighth grade. My dad was trying to help me with something. It didn't go well. But your PowerPoint, I'm all good now. So anyway, that was summarized very well. I appreciate it. I'm ready to move forward.
Okay, just, this is a complex subject. I guess in a bull market, everybody's an investment genius, and then when the bottom falls out, you see who is the emperor wearing their clothes, I guess, as it were. And I'm sympathetic to the idea that our investment manager has statutory limitations on what we can invest in, that the return of capital is more important many times than the return on capital. So I hope we're mindful of that going forward. And just things like the economic climate continuing on today with interest rates. You know, it used to be you could safely invest in bonds and things like that, and now you get, you know, fractions of a percent return. So hopefully the gurus at PERS are, if they're getting these high rates, that they're paying attention to safety. But I'm also prepared to move on with this tonight. So with that, I guess we'll look for a motion.
I move approval that the City Council direct staff to engage Bartell Associates, LLC, to provide actuarial analysis services and receive and review information on the staff. I don't think we need to include it in the motion. Thank you.
Okay, it's been moved and seconded that we adopt the staff recommendation to engage Bartell Associates. May I have a roll call, please?
Mayor Pro Tem Barnidge.
Yes.
Councilmember Brown?
Yes.
Councilmember Guthrie?
Yes.
Councilmember Harmon?
Yes.
And Mayor Hill?
Yes. Moving on, item 12, City Council reports. I attended the South San Luis Obispo County Sanitation District meeting, and some of the ongoing discussions there was authorization of a reclaim water study. Which may, I guess the idea is to look at the potential for increased treatment of the wastewater discharge stream to enable perhaps reinjection into the groundwater basin. So that's just a study that's pretty much looking at feasibility and cost at this time. The Sanitation District Board did make a settlement offer in the Sanitation District versus State of California and Regional Water Quality Control Board lawsuit. I can't say what that settlement offer was, but typically those kinds of offers involve a partial cash payment and then some environmental mitigation projects. There's also ongoing litigation with the Special District's insurance fund for potential recovery of some litigation cost. The plant itself is running very well, although there's no redundancy. At the tail end of the process, there's only one fixed film reactor, which should that malfunction or go down for a long period of time would leave a portion of the process incomplete. And one of the items that we received just recently was a report on redundancy for that portion of the system to include either an activated sludge process, probably to go in a secondary clarifier, a redundant secondary clarifier, which they also do not have, to provide for redundancy in that system so that they can always meet the waste discharge requirements, even in the event of equipment malfunctions. So those are the ongoing issues there. The potential cost for that was mentioned for the redundant equipment is on the order of $12 million. So it's not cheap to provide those additional portions of the process. Briscoe Halcyon Interchange Subcommittee did not meet, and that's a little disconcerting to me. I'm becoming nervous about moving forward in our forward momentum on this item just because of the potential funding issues from other agencies, SLOCOG and others. And hopefully we'll come up with a viable alternative or more than one viable alternative that can be funded and look at proceeding with that in the very near term, I would hope. Oversight Board to the successor agency to the dissolved Arroyo Grande Redevelopment Agency. I got it all out. Didn't even mess it up. We looked at sale of a couple of properties, which is basically starting the process to divest those properties, and there's a formal process that has to go on. One of those properties was the Faye Avenue has been recently had an assessment done to determine the market value, so we don't have to redo that. Let's see, CJPIA is something that meets only, I think, once a year, so there was no meeting on that. That's all that I have. Mayor Pro Tem Barnidge?
Let's see, Zone 3 did not meet. The regular HSOC meeting did not meet the HSOC, but I volunteered to be on an ad hoc committee for the HSOC, which is to do with warming centers, and we did meet. And what we're discussing is the goal is to get a warming center in every jurisdiction in the county. Right now, Roy Grande has a warming center for the homeless, and the county has a warming center. And there was a gentleman that came to the HSOC meeting who had started a group in Paso called Paso Cares, and he started it when a gentleman that was a senior citizen died on the streets from being, he froze to death. And so he really took the information to PASO, and I'm not really sure how all the politics worked, but it wasn't working. So he came down to the HSOC meeting. He brought it before us, and so we formed a committee, and we're going to be doing some outreach and some talking to the newspapers and hopefully sort of getting the information out there that every city in the county really needs a warming center. As the mayor mentioned, when we had the warming center open the last month when it was cold over three nights and rainy, that there were people that were there that stayed there. And so it's definitely needed, and it's really important, and I don't think that people are taking it seriously enough. And so we're going to try to work to hopefully have warming centers in each city is what we're hoping for. So that was a good meeting, and that's all I have to report.
And I think it's Dwayne DeBlau that owns the building there, made it available, a portion of it available for that. So to commend him for that, the wonderful offer of that facility. Councilmember Guthrie.
Start with SLOCOG. Not a lot happened there. The only thing that I really think that was actually on the meeting agenda was the low carbon emissions grant that we've applied for that would pay for the additional bus route that we're looking at in the South County. That would, I think I've described it before, but it's a sort of a commuter route that would run in the morning and the evening, connecting Oceano all the way up to Pismo and going through the Walmart shopping center as well. I think that the big thing that is coming up is in April, we will be voting on the plan is to vote on the regional transportation plan, which is I think it's a 20-year plan, but every 5 years you renew it. So it's certainly something worth reading the executive summary on. It's a very, very long report. But again, as I've mentioned, I think the key parts of it that affect us are the kinds of improvements like weaving lanes and relocating a couple of the on and off ramps in the Shell Beach area, and actually Briscoe Halcyon is funded in there as well. So those are the key parts of it that affect us, but it is a countywide transportation plan. The March meeting has been canceled, so there'll be no report next month. There's no South County Transit report. I did sit in with the Tourism Committee just yesterday, and they are doing a little extra funding here, as noted. The TOT is up. May very well be as a result of that. It may be reflective of that it's up all around. But I do think it's the T-bids in general, not just ours, but all of them together, are certainly affecting the regional business. And let's see, Briscoe Halcyon. I'll just add to that. Yeah, I have serious concerns as well. I think as you saw, what we saw as being one or two concerns have all of a sudden come back to five pages of concerns from Caltrans on the project. So exactly how that I did call, actually, we didn't talk to Tim Gubbins. Actually, he called me back this morning and expressed my concern to him. I guess I'll just relate that some of what he relates is exactly what we hear from applicants with us as well. It says, well, yeah, the comments changed because the project changed, which I don't think is the case, but that's their view of it, is that there were pieces of it that they hadn't looked at before. But they are going back to some of the very original documents at this point, and hopefully we can get that straightened out. He did say he was surprised at the comments. He didn't expect that kind of depth or change in the comment level. So hopefully they'll straighten some things out on their end, and our staff can get with them and bring it to an acceptable conclusion. And hopefully we will be back here in a couple of months, because it's true, if we get another year down the road, we will risk losing the funding for Briscoe Halcyon. Yeah, I have GPI on mine as well, but I think you're the primary, so I have no report on that either. And that's it for me. Thank you.
Councilmember Brown.
Thank you so much. Integrated Waste Management canceled the January meeting, which is fairly typical. I went to my first EVC meeting. It was awesome. I loved it. It was very energetic. Large group of diverse people that were really excited about the economic vitality of the community. And they had a presentation which surprised me somewhat, talking about we did really well compared to a lot of other cities from 2008 forward in the economic downturn. We didn't get hit as hard. But there was a lot of expressed frustration during the presentation that the lower wage rung of people, they basically had three different wage rungs they were talking about, and the lower wage is where we're at in San Luis to a large degree, and that's not increasing. And then a lot of the higher wage people that are living in San Luis are actually leaving San Luis to work elsewhere, even if they live in San Luis. So they're trying to figure out how to increase the wage rates to match the housing costs and raise the standard of living for a large group of people within San Luis County, because they just said even though we did better than a lot during the economic downturn, there's still a lot of people that are just he didn't use the word poverty, but they're just on the low end. And so there was a lot of frustration about that, and hiring good people at those wage rates was hard to do. So anyway, it was a great report he did, the gentleman whose name I've forgotten, and everybody I think here should go there at least once or twice. It's so much more pleasant than another committee I was on before. Very much enjoyed it, and I hope to bring more back to you guys in the months coming. That's my report.
Councilmember Harmon.
Thank you. The Water Resources Advisory Committee, the main topic was the subcommittee's report. I think in January I indicated there was a subcommittee that was going to review the county's plan regarding the resource summary report of the resource management system, which is one that pertains to water supplies, water systems, and wastewater systems. I was very impressed with the subcommittee's work. They did it within a very short turnaround. It was very specific, and more importantly, they brought out several discrepancies that were in some of the groundwater table supply, just the quantities, the analysis that was used. And they weren't, I mean, they were very thoughtful and very specific with that. And also, I thought the request to remove the Atascadero sub-basin from the county planning's consideration for a level 3 severity. Even I understood what they were talking about, so it was a very good process. I'm just going to continue to monitor that to see how much shakes out when County Planning Department reevaluates that and then moves that forward to the next phase, which would be the Board of Supervisors. So going to keep an eye on that one. The Air Pollution Control District, the noteworthy item there pertained to the Environmental Protection Agency's proposal to change the National Air Quality Standard for ozone to a new standard of between 65 and 70 parts per billion. California's current standard for the ground ozone is 70 parts per billion. The APCD informed that our county would be able to maintain compliance should EPA reduce the national standard to 70. Right now, the national standard's at 75. However, raised concerns of non-attainment if the EPA were to reduce it to 65 parts per billion. The EPA is currently taking public comments and is required to review the standard every 5 years. But if it reduces to 65, that could be a big concern for how the county then has to shift and address to meet those standards. And lastly, the Five Cities Fire Authority, the board authorized the submittal of a SAFER grant request. Right now it's just the submittal process. The deadline is March 6th to get that in. The grant request is for $741,000. $630 dollars to fund three engineers. I think everyone knows that the last grant went forward with 12 positions. This one is a much smaller request for three engineers. It would be a two-year period. And I think to note for the city for the future is the fact that commencing in the third year, that cost to the city, if it all moves forward, is close to $167,000, because each jurisdiction would have to pick up one of those engineers to sustain. Just throwing that out there, Chief Lieberman does plan to come before the council to not only explain those specifics, consequences to them, but give us an overall update of kind of like the state of the authority, so to speak. And lastly, our meeting times have been changed to 10 a.m. in the morning, not at 2 p.m., which they are currently, still on the third Friday of every month. Thank you. That's all I have.
Okay, is there any public comment? Hearing none. Council communications. Start with Councilmember Guthrie.
Mm-hmm. No communication. Other than I did really appreciate the tour of the police facility. I do think it was a good time to see it before they get all the walls in. Far different than I remember it. But thank you.
Mayor Pro Tem Barnidge.
No, nothing.
I wasn't able to do one tour of the police facility, but I did get a tour with Councilmember Harmon. Thanks to Chief Annibale for that. It was very enlightening, and there's miles of cable in that. It's amazing the IT infrastructure that's going in there. I also had an opportunity to ride along last Saturday night on the night shift with the police department, and I continue to be amazed at the professionalism and the service that they provide for the city. Councilmember Harmon.
No, I don't have any comments. Thank you.
Councilmember Brown.
Nothing. Thank you.
Staff communications.
Only just one item in response to the comment on Briscoe. We will be bringing back on March 10th a report to council to give you a full status of where things are right now, where it stands with them, and also some considerations to some options to consider on a moving forward basis as far as the options. And then and hopefully shortly thereafter, the project development team will be meeting, which was canceled, unfortunately, as a result of the new comments that came in. But that would be scheduled shortly so we can get it back on track as quickly as possible.
Thank you. I'll ask the city clerk to introduce the next item.
Yeah, item 15 is community comments and suggestions. This public comment period is an invitation to members of the community to present issues, thoughts, or suggestions, or to comment on any scheduled closed session items. Comments should be limited to those matters that are within the jurisdiction of the City Council, and the Brown Act restricts the Council from taking any formal action on matters not published on the agenda.
Would any member of the public like to comment?
Yes. John Keene, 298 North Elm Street. After seeing everybody's reaction to the $31,000 for the lighted crosswalks, I hope that the next time somebody comes up here from the community and asks for one of those crosswalks, you'd make a big decision that they are not cost-effective. The sad thing about it is that technology is just like all technology going right now. And I guarantee you in 7 years when we need to do this again, they won't even be available. You won't even be able to fix them. Just please keep that in mind. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other public comment? Okay, hearing none, may I ask council to announce the closed session?
Yes, Mr. Mayor. We will be adjourning to closed session to consider conference with legal counsel, existing litigation pursuant to Government Code Section 54956.9D1. The name of the case is Santa Maria Valley Water Conservation District versus the City of Santa Maria et al. And related actions. Santa Clara Superior Court case number CV 770214.
Thank you. We're adjourned to closed session.